evening, friends, neighbors, working class heroes. How does that go? He does that every time. Everybody. And now I just sound like Beavis or Butthead or both of them. But I am not Rick Smith. I am Pat LaMarche. Rick's not even, don't even look for him this week. He's playing hooky or doing crazy things. I don't know. He's got somebody else in here tomorrow night. He got me tonight. I'm very happy to be here for a whole pile of reasons I'm going to tell you about in a few minutes. But it's a great Tuesday evening, and my God, have we got a show coming up. Extremely excited to be able to talk to Major General Don Edwards. He was the military comment dude for Fox News. Major General Don Edwards was former Adjutant General of the state of Vermont. He spent 11 million years in the regular military as well, and best buds with Schwarzkopf and some other very important people who have had basically their hands on the future of the United States. And we're going to talk to him about Syria, because for the life of me, I don't get it. I don't understand, and blah, 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 I don't get it. We're also talking to an eighth-grade math teacher from Philadelphia. Okay, don't get it. More don't get it. Nothing's making sense. George Orwell, here you go. War is peace. Learning is not learning. Starve the teachers. You know, feed the Wall Street bad guys. Anyway, so we're going to talk about whether or not you have a right to food. What kind of justice is food justice? What kind of justice is food justice? You should be able to eat. That's the justice part of it. Starving people are not allowing churches to feed homeless people. Are you kidding me? You know, WWJD. We just need to buy that hat for everybody on the police departments all across the country that are enforcing these rules and the crazy town councils that are passing them. In Houston, in fact, it's not only against the law to feed the homeless, it's against the law for the homeless to feed themselves. A man who was rummaging through a trash can and pulled out a donut was arrested for basically disturbing the trash in Houston earlier this week. Ugh, amazing stuff. Texas, I tell you what, I'd say it's something in the water, but it hasn't rained there in years. Oh, but don't worry, Governor Perry's praying for rain. Anyway, but real quickly, just, you know, today.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And that is, of course, Neil Armstrong, Apollo 11. Neil Armstrong passed away today at the age of 82. Condolences to the United States of America and the rest of the world. I mean, and, of course, his family. But, boy, the astronauts were my heroes when I was a kid. I loved that whole space exploration thing. I loved every bit of it. I don't remember what time the stepping on the moon thing happened, but I do remember that we were allowed to watch it. When I was growing up and when I was a kid, you could only watch an hour of TV a day, unless you picked the news, and then you could watch the news plus an hour of TV. And I always saved it for Star Trek. So at this point, 1969, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and we were allowed to watch it. And so we were all sort of huddled around the TV set in the basement, and just amazing stuff. And then, of course, you know, Neil Armstrong realizing that the lunar module wasn't going to land in the right place, he had to. And, you know, they didn't have the technology in Apollo 11 was not as much technology. The whole thing was not as much technology as you have in your iPhone. So this was pretty amazing stuff. And so Neil Armstrong landed it. He and, what was it, Buzz, I think, landed, stepped out on the moon together. And then from there, of course, moved on to the history books. And just a great, great American, a great worldian, citizen of the world. And I don't know, I feel like a chapter of my life ended today because Neil Armstrong died. But anyway, that's the news. My day, real quickly. Just to tell you how wonderful. I don't know this bus driver's name. I ride the bus to work. I love riding the bus, actually. It's always nice and cool. I found out today is Wi-Fi. I didn't even know it had Wi-Fi. I opened my computer so I could start typing a note because I was, like, sort of having a trauma moment, which I'll tell you why in a sec. But I'm having this trauma moment. I open my computer. It says wireless networks available. And, of course, we're driving through Carlisle. So I just assume it's the houses we're going by. And now, boom. The cat has Wi-Fi. hopped on, and that was handy because I broke my iPhone again, and I have none now. And so I had to let Brett know approximately when to let me in the building. And because of what happened on the way to work today, I was very, very late for work. So this is what happened. I love this bus driver. He's a wonderful bus driver. He is so kind and compassionate, and there's a little old man. He's not even that old. I don't even think he's 70. At least I don't think so. Anyway, he always helps him, you know, especially to get off the bus because this guy is so fragile. And today the old fellow was sort of like, no, I got it. And he turned and backed off the bus. But when he turned to sort of back out of the bus, all of a sudden his head turned kind of purple and he jerked backward and he just slammed out of the bus and smashed his head onto the pavement. So the bus driver leapt up, raced over to him. I'm looking out the window. I don't see either one of these guys anymore. The guy isn't getting up. The bus driver's not getting up. I'm like, oh, my God, what's happened? I run out to the front of the bus, and the bus driver's leaning over this man, and the man is just bleeding like I have never seen somebody bleed. So I get out of the bus, and I go over, and this poor man, he's trying to hold his own head up. And so I didn't know what to do. I mean, what do you do? Average human beings aren't trained to handle these things. Maybe I'm not average. Maybe I'm a little sub-average, so maybe a more average person would have known what to do. I did not know what to do. The man's hands are out, and I hold his hands, and I say, can I get something to put under your head? Because it was very obvious that he was awkwardly holding his head up. And he said, yes, please. And I'm thinking, my God, if I was losing that much blood, I don't know if I'd remember to say please. So I think, I can't let go of his hands. Where am I going to go? What am I going to get him? So I start wondering. I don't think my backpack would be good because it's dirty. And then I think, well, okay, so what if it's dirty? At least it'll hold his head up. So I think I'm going to let go of him and run on the bus. All of a sudden, this man appears with rubber gloves. I don't know where he came from. I don't know what was happening around me because I was just paying attention to this man. So I put the rubber gloves on, and then instead of holding his hands, I hold the man's head. And so you could feel him, like, relax and let his head go so that I was holding his head up. And at that point, a nurse runs over and she says, I'm a nurse. And she was amazing. And she said, I'm going to get my kit. What kind of medicines is he taking? And so I'm asking him. And another one of the guys, there were two guys with rubber gloves and this nurse. So the two guys with rubber gloves, one of them said, what day is it? And the man knew it was Tuesday and told us his name. And the nurse comes back, and she's got gauze, and they're trying to stop the bleeding with the gauze, but the blood is running over this guy's hands. It's just incredible. Down into the gutter. I'm thinking, how can people survive trauma like this day in, day out? Well, we send folks to Iraq, or we send them to Afghanistan, we send them all these places, and we traumatize them like this. I'm thinking, oh, it's just so incredible and frightening. And so the bus driver, of course, is right on top of things. He's called his dispatcher, whomever. He's called the ambulance first, and then he called the bus company. And then we're all holding his head. Now there's several of us. The ambulance arrives, and the ambulance people say, don't let go of his head and keep it very still. So the man is holding the gauze on his head, and I are holding this man's head as still as we can. And the ambulance people wrap his head, they get a neck brace on him, they roll him onto a board. He doesn't know the day anymore. He's obviously losing, he's still unconscious, but he couldn't answer the same questions he had answered maybe 3 or 4 minutes earlier. And it's getting very frightening now. I don't know what's happened to this man, which also I'm hoping someone knows. It's 888-520-RICK or 888-520-7425. If you want to talk about politics or anything, you're welcome to call. But also, if you know anything about this poor fellow that was taken to the hospital, and I don't know what hospital they took him to. Anyway, so they take the man, they go to put him in the ambulance. I turn around, and this 20-year-old kid that was on the bus, approximately 20, your bus with me, he just passes out right in front of me. That is how horrible the scene was. So we had to get another paramedic crew, and it was just, I get on the bus, and I'm thinking, I got to write this down because that's how I process. I type. And as I said, I opened my laptop and realized that there was Wi-Fi, and I emailed Brett and said, I'm going to be late. And when I got here, Brett gave me a thug hug. So everything's okay now. I hope everything's okay with the old fella. Hats off to Kat. I don't know who this bus driver is, although I see him all the time because he drives my bus, but I just think he's a hero and a wonderful man, and so were those two guys with the rubber gloves and that nurse. And the guy who jumped out of his car and started directing traffic so no one ran us over. I mean, everybody that at the scene on North Hanover Street in Carlisle was just first rate. They made me happy to be a person. And I think if we all treated each other this way all the time, we wouldn't be blowing the living daylights out of it. Well, maybe I should put that differently. We wouldn't be bombing people. We wouldn't be destroying each other. We would be loving each other and caring about each other like we did this old man, you know? Just amazing. Anyway, I'm Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith is going to be in, I don't know, next week sometime. But what?
Thursday.
Oh, well, Thursday next week, so I'll say. He'll be back Thursday. There's going to be somebody else. Who's coming to be in tomorrow, Rick?
Steve Herzenberg.
I'm going to have to listen to him. I don't know that guy. Anyway, but I'm here for tonight. I'm Pat LaMarche. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of the Rick Smith Show.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Port truck drivers at Greenfleet Systems in Los Angeles are calling a one-day strike, protesting what they say is anti-union harassment and intimidation from the company. The Teamsters are helping the drivers to organize. The Teamsters say unfair labor practice charges were filed with the NLRB alleging the harassment by Greenfleet and its hired union busters. The unfair labor practice strike will include picketing and a large rally complete with Teamsters big rigs rolling up at the port to support the strike. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says drivers who should be employees are instead being treated like independent contractors.
They're made to pay for everything, for the fuel, for new tires, all the business expenses that the companies that they work for should be paying is passed on to these drivers. And even the few drivers who are employees and have some rights are really, can't make ends meet, have no paid time off, no health insurance. And so drivers are fed up.
Weiner says the Teamsters had an organizing victory earlier this year at ports in Los Angeles and New Jersey. Labor community leaders and Washington, D.C. City Council members today are calling on Washington's mayor to sign the Large Retailer Accountability Act. The act calls for giant retailers with more than $1 billion annual revenue and stores of 75,000 square feet or more to pay workers at least $12.50 an hour plus benefits. Supporters of the act say it's a fair deal for a living wage. The event is part of the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. University of Miami custodians could soon be walking the picket lines. Jesse Russell reports.
The workers vote in favor of strike action if an agreeable contract can't be reached by August 31st. The custodial workers are unhappy with a proposed 10-cent raise, as many of the workers only earn $8.55 per hour. The university contracts with DTZ Incorporated, who provides custodial workers. So far, the school has chosen to not get involved with negotiations. The custodial staff at the university also went on strike in 2006 for 9 weeks. They were demanding that they be allowed to organize. Most of the custodial staff is represented by the Service Employees International Union.
Strike action continues to spread in South Africa. Strikes that began at gold mines and in the automobile manufacturing sector have now spread to airports and construction sites. Nearly 200,000 workers have downed tools in the nation, and in all cases, the workers are seeking better wages. Combined, the industries account for 15% of South Africa's economy.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not close. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hope of its children. 99,
I love that quote from Dwight D. Eisenhower, and I am sorry that we have to use it so often on this show. It's like, is anyone remembering the cross of iron that we're all getting crucified on? White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said today that the White House is not considering a deliberate overthrow of Assad. The options that we are considering are not about regime change, he said during a daily briefing with reporters. They are about responding to the clear violation of an international standard that prohibits the use of chemical weapons. Is there not a standard that prohibits the use of other weapons? Like, you did something, and what about where these bombs are going to fall? You killed some innocent people, so we're going to come, what, kill some more? I don't get it. And when I don't get it, which, all right, sometimes is often, but really, I try to pay attention. I go to Major General Don Edwards because he is clear-thinking and smart and gets these guys to some degree. Major General Don Edwards, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Oh, I'm not sure I really believe in this person, Don Edwards. Oh,
he's spectacular and a gardener, but we'll get to that later. What is going on? You and I have been talking about this for years.
Yep. Assad and his company have stepped over. All logic says they have stepped over the line. I frankly don't understand why. They apparently, from everything I can read and understand and pick up from the context, they really did serve gas and they killed hundreds of people. I know the people are fighting, but somebody had to close that retribution.
Hey, Don, hang on a second. You're breaking up really badly. Are you on?
Well,
did we
go
call
to another? Let me go to another corner of my rural Maine house.
Yeah, because I can say what I think I heard you say and just repeat it while you're moving to another part of the house, which was they used chemical weapons and killed hundreds of people.
Yep.
Okay.
How do you sound now?
You sound better.
Good.
Okay.
That's good. Good.
Are we going to who are we satisfying by bombing more people, though?
Well, I don't know that we're satisfying anybody. In fact, you could make a very good case that we backed ourselves into a corner.
Right, by saying, oh, well, it's okay as long as he doesn't use chemical weapons. But the minute he uses, and you know the tinfoil hat people say, he may not even have used them. The rebels might have used them to get us involved.
Well, I think it's highly improbable that the rebels used them. I do think that what you hear and read and whatever about the fact that they were fired probably by the 4th Division, which is commanded by President Assad's brother, I think that's probably quite accurate. I have no doubt in my mind that the nerve gas was used by the Syrian regime. That's, to me, not a debatable subject.
Mm-hmm.
What is debatable is, what do you do about it?
Yeah. And, you know, part of the issue, I don't know, there were too many parts of the issues, but let me try and break them down a little bit. One part of the problem is allegedly these weapons came from Russia. Russia and China want us to cut it out. By the way, the chemicals we gave Saddam Hussein were the ones that he used. So I think, first of all, Pollyanna wants us to quit selling these crazy people stuff like that. But are we going to get a pushback from the Russians and the Chinese if, as they say in news reports now, we're going to start bombing on Thursday?
I think two questions there, Pollyanna. We don't have any more nerve left to sell. We've destroyed it.
Good.
And that's good. I think the Russians and the Chinese will jump up and down, spin around, scream and yell, and they can't do a thing.
Yeah.
The question is, can we, if we do something, and my suspicion is that we will, can we do it without being drawn further into this particular mess? And I certainly hope so.
Well, yeah, because the Major General Don Edwards, I know, is no boots on the ground in this mess, boys.
That's exactly right. No boots on the ground. I think what we'll see, you know, and believe me, I'm not in the White House. I don't have any contacts in the White House. They're not talking to me. But everything that I see, read, and hear both in the media and offline with my friends who were my professional friends, is we're very liable to see some standoff weapons, Tomahawk missiles with 1,000-pound warheads, which are not small, several hundred of them perhaps, fired against various targets in Syria. And those targets could very well range from the headquarters of the 4th Division, which apparently did use the nerve gas, to the rocket sites and the rocket equipment that were used, the artillery equipment that was used, and perhaps even some of the major government facilities like the intelligence headquarters and the defense headquarters. We're not going to see troops on the ground, and we are not going to see firing at nerve gas sites because you cannot destroy it with bombs.
Oh, I see, because you're just going to blow the stuff up and then it's going to be vaporized and aerated or whatever the words are. So,
and kill thousands of people.
Right. So when you have we've shown, the president with his kill list has shown that he's got the stomach for targeted murders that he feels will keep Americans safer, to paraphrase for him, although I find it hard to believe he can believe that, although I'm sure that what he says he believes. I'm a mess right now about Obama. I just am so disgusted. Anyway, he has proven that he has the capacity to just kill the guys he wants to, for the most part. Every now and then somebody innocent gets it. Why doesn't he just kill this brother? And what is it with all these guys hiring their brothers and stuff to, you know?
God, Pat, I love you.
I love you too, Don.
Oh, my word. What was that, targeted murder? Was that the expression you used? That was wonderful. I got to tag that one away for future reference. Well, we might very well. I mean, the guy's not listening to you and me, so I guess we can talk about it. But we've got adequate intelligence capability where somebody may be following his movement around Damascus, and from a Predator or some other satellite device. And at Thursday morning, which everybody seems to be saying was going to be the time, he may walk into the 4th Division headquarters and pour his first cup of tea, and the wrath of hell descends upon him. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I hope so, because and now you can accuse me of being a murderous person, but this guy is really a murderous guy. The world, and the women and children of the opposition and Syria will not miss him if he disappears.
Right. Now, of course, I believe in things like trials by juries and all that other crap, but if we know, if this...
All that crap. Okay,
yeah, we've got omniscience to the point where we know that he's got his finger on the gas trigger, right? And he meets his maker after his cup of tea. That, to me, because this whole war business, and I'm certain you know I'm only an armchair warrior. I just watch from the comfort of whatever radio station I'm in. But this whole war business is nasty. And if you can keep it down to one or two people instead of 1,000, you know, you got a lot of gray area when it comes to war. And that, to me, seems like a better use of the gray area.
Well, let's be really brutal. Not gray area, it's called red with blood.
Mm.
And lots of people get killed, and it's extraordinarily nasty, and I've seen more of it than I ever want to hear of or see of again.
Yeah.
So if we start firing 300 Tomahawk missiles, people are going to die.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether they're Shia, loyal to Assad or whatever, hundreds of people are probably going to die. Yeah, you can make it a very surgical thing. We're going to get the artillery, we're going to get the rockets, we're going to get the 4th Division headquarters. Well, there's a couple hundred people in the 4th Division headquarters.
Yeah.
War is not any clean, neat, surgical thing. It's you can make surgical strikes and hopefully not get any civilians, but it's very messy, and people are going to die. And if one of the rockets we should fire should have a guidance error of the slightest, or a fuel error of the slightest, it could end up impacting who knows where,
right,
killing hundreds of people. So this could very well be quite messy.
This problem has been a festering boil for years. We were just unable. I mean, I remember interviewing you the day that we found out that the bad guys, and I don't know who they are because there's like 25 sides, but the bad guys had commandeered the UN vehicles and commandeered the rescue vehicles, and they were going to scenes as though they were the UN or the rescuers, and then killing everybody. So,
yep.
This has been a bad thing. And what have we ever just thought of saying, tell you what, we're going to just start taking people out of that country that want to get out. We're going to give refugee status. And I'm not saying just dump them all in Montana, although that is a very spacious area. But I understand bad guys might try to get out with the good guys, but is there nothing that we can do about saying this is just a viper's nest and let, it give us the children?
Well, you know, I love you, my dear, but that's a fairly simplistic outlook on life.
I know it is.
I'm not sure the people who are coming out of Syria want to go to Montana or Alabama or Maine.
Yeah.
I don't think they want to stake in their kids. I think they want to keep their families together, and they would really like to go back to Syria and have the same country. The problem with all of this, if we can take the lens and widen our scope, if you look at what happened in Libya after the intervention in Libya,
mm-hmm.
we've got a total mess. In Egypt, I don't know if it's a total mess, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
And the problem with these kinds of regimes, like the Assad brothers, is, okay, you get rid of them. Well, what next? You get a Sunni al-Qaeda government, which is quite possible, because as I'm sure if you stay up with what's going on, there's a very strong, deeply conservative al-Qaeda Sunni-type military force in Syria now fighting the government. If Assad and company go away, which I still think eventually they will,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think our intervention is going to cause that to happen, but I think eventually they'll go away, there's great potential for a humongous mess to occur.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure where we can see that going, Pat.
All right. You know, I know that I'm simplistic in this, and a lot of the stuff I pluck out of the mess that's between my ears is out of history, and all I can think of is those boatloads of Jewish children that were sent out of Germany, you know? And then I guess the other thing that I think about in this whole mess is what we've talked about before also, is the fact that all of the lines of these countries are drawn by people who really didn't care about anything except their own agenda at the time they're being drawn. And there's all this tribalism that's never been respected.
Yep. I don't want to call you simplistic. If I indicated that, I don't mean that.
Oh, no, I agree that it's simplistic because I'm a mommy.
Well, and I honor your mores. I mean, the plight of the Jewish children and the fact that the United States refused to accept mm-hmm. Jewish refugees has haunted me all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it should any of us who are thinking people.
Mm-hmm.
The problem here is, let me run a couple of scenarios for you that are... Assad probably cannot retaliate against the United States. We've got four destroyers out there, maybe a nuclear submarine or two, and we fire 300 missiles. Not much he can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just decide. Let's just say that he gets somewhat upset about all of this, and he and his brother load a whole bunch of nerve gas into rockets,
mm-hmm.
and they fire them at Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go from there?
Well, that is I'm sure that is the 5,000-pound gorilla that is in the room anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing, that real quickly going to Egypt, and I'm running over a little bit of time, but I'm so excited to talk to you, and I really do look to you for you. My mom died 15 years ago, and since then I have never, until I met you, I didn't have a person to talk to when I was this confused. You know, she was just so smart. Oh,
that's very sweet. Thank
that's
you.
That's true. You know, France had five revolutions before they got it.
Yep.
You know, and everybody thinks, oh, they're, you know, 1789, July 14, 1789, a couple of heads rolled and then, you know, life changed. And I don't think they understand that when you build your own new reality, there's a lot of false starts and messy realities. And yet we expect these regimes that are changing themselves or even with our help or not to just all of a sudden, like, settle out like a jello mold full of pineapple slices.
Well, all I can say to that is amen, because as you well know, in our case, it didn't happen that easily,
mm-hmm.
and it took years, and in fact, we had a civil war,
mm-hmm.
and it took 150 years before we gave women the right to vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no quick, simple process in our own country, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's messy in Egypt, and none of us know for sure where it goes, but we do know where it's been, and that didn't work. And I can't condemn what's going on in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood certainly was not moving some democracy forward, and
right.
I think we need to be a little more understanding and patient, as you say.
Now, one last question. If I know we're not going to do this, so it's probably a waste of both of our air, but if we didn't retaliate, retaliate's a funny word because they kind of didn't do it to us. They did it to humanity, and that's, I guess, what the retaliation's for. If we didn't do anything, if we just said, you know, we're not the world's policemen, and I'm not necessarily advocating for that because I really am confused, what would happen in Syria?
Well, I would think that Iran and North Korea, who have certain nuclear ambitions, would rub their hands and say, look at those. We need Americans. They draw red lines and they say they're going to do this and they don't do anything. So why don't we just go ahead and make all kinds of nuclear weapons and put them on ballistic missiles, and in the case of Iran, we'll shoot at Israel.
So we've got our bravado now to protect.
Bravado. You are tough, lady. You are tough. We certainly need to either put up or shut up. How's that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with that, I guess I'll shut up.
Always great to talk to you.
I love you, Don Edwards. Thanks for joining us.
Exactly.
I'm Pat LaMarsh. I'm in for Rick Smith. We're going to be back in just a minute. That was Major General Don Edwards. Wonderful having him on the show. We'll be right back.
America. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
With its merger taking off, American Airlines' swashbuckling PR slogan proclaimed, two great airlines, one great future. That wasn't about its present attempt to merge with U.S. Airways, but about its 2001 takeover of TWA. Since then, American's honchos have relentlessly cut flights, jacked up fees, fired thousands of excellent employees, turned flying into a misery, and plunged the high-flying corporation into bankruptcy. Some great future. Now, American wants to take the same route by hooking up with U.S. Air, again proclaiming that the combination will be great. But for whom? Not for passengers. In July, Consumer Reports magazine revealed that American and U.S. Air were tied for ninth worst out of 11 big airlines in a survey of customer satisfaction. Two bad performers won't add up to a good one. Indeed, the combined entity looks to be so bad for the flying public that even the toothless antitrust watchdogs of the Justice Department are at least barking at this merger, having filed suit to block it. If the two join, only four giants would control nearly 90% of U.S. flights. Well, snapped the oligopolists, that's just how the free market works. Yeah, as in free to gouge. From its earliest days, this industry has been heavily subsidized and protected, and the last thing its bureaucratic profiteers want is actually having to compete with each other. They haven't become giants by being agile competitors for customer loyalty, but by dividing up the market, colluding on price hikes, cutting amenities, and slashing service. Their only area of real competition is in the annual race to see which airline CEO gets the fattest paycheck. This is Jim Hightower saying, if this merger goes through, get ready for the big four to merge into two, and then the two becomes one, all in the name of free market competition.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
We need to cut the waste so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
Marsh here. I'm riding the radio boards for Rick Smith, who's taking the night off, and we're going to go to a caller real quick. Bill, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, hi, Pat. I wish I could have spoken to the general. I would have liked to have thrown a couple of hard balls at him. I'd just like to give you a few things to think about.
And my intention is to have the general on again with me when I'm back on again, and I'm sure he'll be with Rick. So.
You know, again, I don't want to get on a personal basis, but this is the typical thing that let me put it to you this way. We have been doing everything we could to follow in the footsteps, the colonial footsteps of Britain and France. We've been destabilizing every one of those countries over there, making them from bad to much worse, and we've been supporting the terrorists, including in Syria. Now, I happen to hear Jerome Corthy today, who I don't particularly care for, but he is a published, well-known author and an expert in that area of the world. And he said WorldNet Daily has pulled up, I guess, dozens of videos from the Middle East put out by Al-Qaeda that show them launching those mortar rounds with chemical weapons. Now, here's the question, one of the questions I would have posed to the general. What in the world would Bashar have used chemical weapons on civilians for, knowing damn well that it would have brought on this retaliation? I don't think the man has stayed in power this all these years but by being stupid. That's number one. And
can I just say one thing? And I agree. These are excellent questions. But I'll tell you something about the general. He was the commentator for Fox News, and Fox News got rid of him when he said, "I think the Iraq war is wrong."
Well, you also said he's a friend of Brent Scowcroft, and Brent Scowcroft is a member of Kissinger and Associates.
I didn't say Scowcroft. I said Schwarzkopf.
Oh, Schwarzkopf.
Not that I'm saying he's a whole lot better, but I'm just saying Schwarzkopf.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could get into that, too. But here's another question to consider. You know, he made a statement which I was really surprised a man with his background would make, and that was the cavalier attitude about the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians and the Chinese, from what I understand, are furious about us doing this particularly the Russians, because they do have military stations there. Mm-hmm. And the general says, well, you know, they can jump up and down and yell and everything, or we can't do anything about it. Who owns our debt?
Well, that is China's only power, but I got to tell you something. They would wreck themselves.
Well, they would, but I'll tell you what. I'll tell you, you know, they have a little bit more leverage than people here want to give them credit for, because given it to them. Uh-huh. And neither in the case of Putin nor the Chinese, they've got their lines in the sand, too. And they have their interests over there, too, which really, if you want to do the research, you'll find out that it all boils down to pipelines, as usual.
Well, I think, you know, you're a nicer guy than I. I think it all boils down to the military-industrial complex. I don't think they give a rat's, you know, what pipelines. I think that because they talk about oil, everybody driving their car today feels like an accomplice, and so they back down. That's what keeps the American people cowed, is you make them think we're fighting for their oil. But it's not even about
that. Who owns the oil? You know, you've got a handful of families, actually, controlling the world.
So, Bill, I have one question for you, and then I have a guest that I was supposed to get to at 9:30. Mm-hmm. But I have one more question for you real quick. Where have you been all my life? Why are you not calling this show every week?
Well, I mean, I do call Rick sometimes.
Well, you're going to start calling Pat now because you're smart,
clearly. You're not there that much. What can I tell you? And I don't have a computer, so, you know, we're both
smart,
out of luck.
You're smart. You got a great voice. So
thank you.
Anytime you want to, thank you. Anytime you want to weigh in, now I know it's the Bill.
It's the
Bill, and Brett will hold up a big piece of paper that says the Bill is on the phone, and I'll get you on with any guest I've got. Okay.
Well, I have very strong feelings about what's going on in the world today, and I think we're living in extremely dangerous times, and this talk of war all the time is really making me you want to do some research, Pat, that'll keep you up awake at night. Read about EMPs and read how easily we could be hit with an EMP. And if you want to really lose...
You know what, though? I already stay up all night because we're hitting other people with stuff. You know what? I don't think an American life is more valuable than other people's lives, and I'm so sick of that, too.
No, but here, do me a favor, if you can, and it's the fastest read I've ever read in my life. Read the book 1 Second After.
Okay.
Right. And that'll give you something to think about and keep you awake, and, you know, you'll maybe change your mind about a few things. I'm sorry?
Rick already makes me lose sleep, but all right, I'll add you to the list. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling in. Have a great night.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're going to talk about the Philadelphia school system when we come back. Coming right up on the Rick Smith Show.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of 3 representatives from labor and 3 from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was clear that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization unemployment rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Rebuilding America.
The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down.
You can play that for me. Because I'm coming completely unglued and screaming into the radio. And, oh, my God, 25 years of it. How many years? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah. No, more than that. Yeah, no. 24 years of broadcast experience flattened tonight by some poor old man bleeding almost, hopefully, going to be fine, but looked like he was bleeding to death on the side of the road. And the poor fella had his head in my hands, and it was just so, oh, and I'm a mess, I'm a wreck. And, you know, I held it together while I was there, and then I've fallen apart ever since. And I had a friend who had a hip replacement, and he had a similar thing where his incision opened, and the whole side of his hip opened, and then I was just Johnny on the spot, helped him, took care of him, the ambulance came, took him on, but his wife got there, and then I went to the grocery store and I fell apart in the fruit aisle. So I'm obviously, I don't have a lot of stick-to-itiveness. I don't know how people deal with a long-term trauma. But maybe I'll find out from a eighth grade math teacher who has to put up with the ridiculous rules of the school departments throughout the state and Governor Corbett and his, you can tell his kids aren't involved. Amy McGinley joining me right now. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. I've had a heck of an evening.
Oh, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right, but I'm bubbling over at the sides here with a lack of talent. So we'll see if we can just get through this interview without me completely destroying everything. So you are an eighth grade math teacher, possibly one of the most important people our children may come in contact with, in my opinion. Not only a teacher, but a math teacher. And, you know, it's no surprise that George W. Bush, a few years ago, pulled us out of the international math and science testing. The year before he pulled us out, we came in right behind South Africa, our kids. So if you take us out of the testing and assessing on a worldwide scale, then you can start dismantling the education system inside the country and no one will know it.
Right.
So you folks have been asked to take a 17% pay cut now. And if you take a 17% pay cut, they'll give you back some teachers they've laid off. Is that the deal you've been offered?
The deal is, according to the contract term set by the district, this is what they're offering on their side, is that all teachers will take a pay cut, depending on how long you've been in service, anywhere from 5 to 13%. And in addition to that, we'll have to pay a portion of our health benefits, again, from 5 to 13%, depending on how long you've been in service. Now, Governor Corbett is saying that there is money that he will free up to give to the district to help with our financial situation, but only after the teachers make concessions.
First of all, the phone is really bad. Are you moving or something?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
Well, I don't know, but your voice keeps getting faint. Okay, so but real quick, the money he's going to free up, and by the way, who made him God? You're a governor.
Yeah.
You're not
right.
God.
But
the money he's talking about freeing up, it's federal money, right?
I'm not exactly sure if it's federal money or if it's state money. I'm not really 100% sure.
And why is he in charge? Why is the governor in charge of Philadelphia schools at all?
Well, because in 2001, when David Hornbeck was our superintendent, he threatened to close the schools if he didn't get more funding from the state. And instead of providing more funding, they passed a law that gave control of the state. To control of the school district to the state of Pennsylvania, and as such, they developed or instituted this school reform commission.
Did anybody, now that commission, that's something we got to talk about real quick, but did anybody like file a lawsuit saying you can't just do this? Or did that just happen?
I believe that the PFT, the Federation, did file some sort of lawsuit, but I don't, obviously it didn't work because for the past 12 years we're still under their control.
So then they made this, Council of Dragons. That's going to govern the school system. And these guys are not people I'd put in charge of my kids' education. They're industry people and CEOs.
Right. There's nobody personally vested in the education. It seems to me that the SRC is on the side of politics. They are not concerned about putting the counselors back into the schools. They're not concerned with putting a nurse into each school full time. They're concerned about their politics. And it's not fair. They want the teachers to step up and sacrifice. We sacrifice every day that we go into our jobs. We have to pay. We pay out of our own pocket to make sure our students have what they need.
And you were telling me earlier today that your students don't have math textbooks. Your kids, I got to say that again. Kids don't have math textbooks, and so
that
you have to photocopy textbooks so that they'll have work to do, and you were put on restriction for the photocopier.
That is correct. Last year, the school that I worked, we did not have an adequate textbook. What happened, we have a Common Core curriculum that it was nationally adopted, so our textbooks did not go with this Common Core. So I had a copy of a workbook, and I photocopied pages so that I could use that as my instructional material and homework for my students. And because I made too many copies, my principal at the time suspended my copier code, not once but twice.
And then you were getting friends to make the other teachers to make the copies for you, and they got warned. Don't make any more copies.
That is correct.
And you know, you're not selling crack. You're making copies.
I'm making copies.
Of a textbook that doesn't exist because the kids don't have a textbook.
Exactly. I mean, and these are materials that our kids need in order to become functioning members of society. I need to give them skills so that when they go to high school and then college, they are prepared. How can I give them skills if they don't have anything to take home? Not every child has a computer in their house.
You got to get a weeping Ben Franklin. You got to get a big painting of a weeping Ben Franklin and just, you know where they hang like the Starship Enterprise or whatever between the pillars there on the Franklin Institute? You need a big weeping Ben. Like, are you kidding me?
I don't think people realize what we go through on a daily basis. How there's a disparity among school districts. And among schools, even in the city of Philadelphia, that certain schools have certain things and other schools don't.
Now, I was reading that half of your students, 40% of your students now are in charter schools, 60% of the kids are still in public schools.
It seems to me, and most other people, that Corbett is a proponent of charter schools, and as is Nutter, it seems to me, because they are directing money that should be going to the school district of Philadelphia to charter schools. They say that charter schools are public education, but how can they be public education if they can pick and choose their students?
Now, you told me that they get money, that this is sucking money out of the Philadelphia school system like crazy. It's sucking money out of the school system. But if they get to February with these kids and they don't want them anymore, they kick the kids back, but they keep the money.
Exactly. They are allotted a certain amount of money per pupil, and that they're given that money from the school district. And if the child is a behavior problem or whatever the child would do to warrant, being dismissed from the school, they can send them back to their neighborhood public school. And we have to take them because every child has the right to a free and appropriate public education. So we have to take the kids, but they get to keep the money for that child.
That is just appalling.
It is appalling.
Now, I would like to know who we send Governor Corbett to when he is inappropriate behavior in the classroom. Because
I'd like Governor Corbett to come and teach for a week. without his security detail, and another two. Come into the schools and take part. Roll up your sleeves, and you see what it's like every day.
Yeah, that would be pretty fabulous, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it sure would.
Would we have a Neil Armstrong who died today at the age of 82? Would we have a Neil Armstrong without mathematics?
No.
Yeah, I mean, you can't do any sciences without mathematics. And then we need the science teachers, too, and the English teachers. And no counselors and no school nurses. You know, ever since they mandated that all kids go to school, school nurses deal with things like brain tumors.
Absolutely. School nurses deal with, you would be surprised. Many of our children are so poor that they don't have access to a regular family physician.
Mm-hmm.
The school nurse becomes their family physician.
Yeah.
They need access to health care. You know, and the school nurse, as limited as it may be, we can provide them with a certain degree of health care.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a nurse in every building, some kids are going to go without.
But if you don't have priorities of health care and you don't have priorities of education, then what you're talking about is falling on incredibly deaf ears.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this is the game plan in every Alec Koch brothers elected governor. The thing that frustrates me the most about Corbett and Scott and LePage and Walker and all of these governors is that they have a playbook. They are no more independent thinkers than this rather unattractive coffee mug on Rick's desk. They are unwelcome in these people's fancy homes. Do not expect that Governor Corbett is like on any of their guest lists. He's used by them, and he's used by them to rape the system of big cash that they can take and put in their pockets. And I find it, if it weren't for the fact that it was hurting so many children and so many people, I would find it pathetic, and I feel pathos for the governors that are these guys' chumps.
Right. Sure. You can't in one breath say, you know, you're doing the best for children, but yet you're holding the teachers hostage. It's basically a bribe. You put these things into place, and then we'll give you the money. Because, you know, you're not in it for the kids, but what, you are?
Yeah.
How does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry that it doesn't. Amy McGinley, thank you for what you do for the children in your classrooms. Thank you for taking the heat for making photocopies rather than just giving kids school books that won't help them, you know. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us here on The Rick Smith Show.
Thank you very much for having me, Pat. I really appreciate it.
Take care, Amy. I'm sorry it took us so long to get to you. It's been a crazy day. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute to talk about energy.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Port truck drivers at Green Fleet Systems in Los Angeles are calling a one-day strike, protesting what they say is anti-union harassment and intimidation from the company. The Teamsters are helping the drivers to organize. The Teamsters say unfair labor practice charges were filed with the NLRB alleging the harassment by Green Fleet and its hired union busters. The unfair labor practice strike will include picketing and a large rally complete with Teamsters big rigs rolling up at the port to support the strike. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says drivers who should be employees are instead being treated like independent contractors.
They're made to pay for everything, for the fuel, for new tires, all the business expenses that the companies that they work for should be paying is passed on to these drivers. And even the few drivers who are employees and have some rights are really, you know, can't make ends meet, have no paid time off, no health insurance. And so drivers are fed up.
Wiener says the Teamsters had an organizing victory earlier this year at ports in Los Angeles and New Jersey. Labor community leaders and Washington, D.C. City Council members today are calling on Washington's mayor to sign the Large Retailer Accountability Act. The act calls for giant retailers with more than $1 billion annual revenue and stores of 75,000 square feet or more to pay workers at least $12.50 an hour plus benefits. Supporters of the act say it's a fair deal for a living wage. The event is part of the commemoration the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. University of Miami custodians could soon be walking the picket lines. Jesse Russell reports.
The workers vote in favor of strike action if an agreeable contract can't be reached by August 31st. The custodial workers are unhappy with a proposed 10-cent raise, as many of the workers only earn $8.55 per hour. The university contracts with DTZ Incorporated, who provides custodial workers. So far, the school has chosen to not get involved with negotiations. The custodial staff at the university also went on strike in 2006 for 9 weeks. They were demanding that they be allowed to organize. Most of the custodial staff is represented by the Service Employees International Union.
Strike action continues to spread in South Africa. Strikes that began at gold mines and in the automobile manufacturing sector have now spread to airports and construction sites. Nearly 200,000 workers have downed tools in the nation, and in all cases, the workers are seeking better wages. Combined, the industries account for 15% of South Africa's economy.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Is that Corbett's voice? Is that the governor? Yeah, he puts the cracker in Cracker Plant, doesn't he? Ah, oh, Governor Corbett. He's going to shut down all the coal plants because they're nasty. Trust me, I'm a tree-hugging hippie freak. I'm not here to debate the good or bad of coal or natural gas. But he's going to get rid of the coal plants, put in a natural gas plant? And that one's going to be, what, free market? Okay, somebody is going to help me make sense of this, and that's Robert Whalen. He's the president of Local 102 Utility Workers United of America. Did I get that right?
No. Utility Workers Union of America.
Oh, for God's sakes. You know, I've had a bad day. You have to forgive me. It was a great day up until the man almost died on the bus, and then on my bus ride, and I've been a mess ever since. And I was okay at the time, but I have too much adrenaline or something, and so my brain has ceased to function. And I apologize to you in advance for whatever I might do wrong in this interview. But, Bob Whalen, first of all, there are a bunch of coal plants that have been closed down just to create what? The premise or the belief that we don't need the energy?
Not so much that. Right now, we believe that it's simply to inflate the price of electricity artificially and
like they did when Katrina hit and gas went from $1 to $3 in 2 days.
Similar to that, except okay. This will be on a much larger and longer scale because something you have to understand about generating plants. First of all, you don't stop and start them on a dime. You got to ramp them up and ramp them down when you're taking them on and offline. But more importantly, you don't build one overnight. These things take a long time to build. There's a lot of engineering put into them. And so there's a tremendous effort to put them all together. But, we seen back in September of 2012 where First Energy closed one of our power stations up in Armstrong County near Katanning, Pennsylvania, and it was one of the most cost-effective power stations that was online. It was
good reason to close it.
Absolutely. It was completely rebuilt in the late 90s, early 2000s, so it was kind of an up-to-date power station. And for the life of us, we couldn't figure out why they were going to shut that plant down. As that process took place, not only did they shut it down, but the last day that it run, they crashed the station so that it could never run again. They made it a big pile of junk, basically, is what they did. So they wanted to make sure that power station could never come back online to provide safe, reliable, cost-effective electric
okay.
to the consumer.
So, Bob, I am now about to prove everything I said in my opening that I am I'm too stupid to do the show tonight. But what happened to public utilities?
Well, it's interesting you say that. In Pennsylvania in 1998, there was a bill passed to allow utility companies to become deregulated on the generating side of the business. So effectively what you have today is you have a situation where companies like First Energy, they own the deregulated piece, which is the generating part, mm-hmm. and then they own the regulated piece, which is the water side of the business, where the electricity comes into your homes and businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the generation piece or the deregulated piece is exactly that. And the state of Pennsylvania cannot tell any electric utility company that they must provide generation to our customers. And, in fact, all these generating stations we're talking about prior to 1998 were built and paid for by the ratepayers of Pennsylvania.
Mm.
And not they were just turned over to the utility companies. Once that took place, they got to run them and do everything they wanted to do with them. And now they're systematically shutting them off and destroying them. So,
well, they didn't pay anything for them. They've made money all this time off of them.
Yes.
They have no value to them.
They have a tremendous value. They have a value by being shut down and deactivated
right.
so that the price of electricity can be artificially
right.
inflated.
So actually they have a negative value if they stay open.
Yes. Yeah, because the stations that we're talking about, Armstrong was one of them, and the two current ones that they're looking to shut down is Hatfield Power Station near Masontown, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
It is what's called a supercritical power station. It's a very large power station to provide a tremendous amount of electricity. Typically, sends a lot of electricity out to New York, out to the East Coast, because it, you know, it has excess generation available to it. And just for example, between Hatfield and Mitchell Power Station at the end of July, when we had that little hot spell come through here for a while,
mm-hmm.
They were making about $250,000 per hour running both them stations all out. And my suggestion was, well, look, if they're not needed, according to the company, and they're not cost-effective, let's shut them off in the middle of this heat wave and see what happens to service reliability.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we believe that the grid is not designed and built to see Hatfield and Mitchell Power Stations offline.
Well, so it was just a few years ago that New York was like, oops, without power.
Exactly.
And that was like grid-wide, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it tied into some of the First Energy facilities. And there's a lot of debate as to why that occurred. You know, one of the theories was that they were trying to push so much power through some high-voltage wires that they sagged them into trees.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the heavy loading conditions, it went black across the northern tier.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's what I heard. We were not with First Energy then. We were with Allegheny Power, and that was kind of the Allegheny Power take on it.
Yeah.
Allegheny Power actually disconnected First Energy during that debacle, my understanding of what took place.
So what happened? Did these guys merge? Is that why it's now First Energy, or is that?
Yes. First Energy took over Allegheny Energy and acquired all their assets.
Now, what kind of company is First Energy? Is that like got its headquarters in, maybe Mechanicsburg on the main street there, Simpson Road or something, and you can walk in and chat with these guys?
No, actually, their corporate offices are in Akron, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And then they own various utility companies throughout Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Maryland, and New Jersey, New York.
So they're pretty much the mid-Atlantic states, and the owners, is this a multinational corporation or?
Yes, yeah, so they're the owners of all these other operating companies and generating companies. So, yeah, but they're based out of Akron, Ohio.
So as you said, this is about Wall Street. It's not about energy.
That's what it's all about. It's all about making this company even richer than they already are, as what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to come at the ratepayers' expense. And here's what our major concern is. If you end up taking the Hatfield and the Mitchell Power Stations offline, similar to what they did with Armstrong, and they're no longer able to come back and run in some short period of time, and this trend continues because we're seeing some other utilities follow the same suit as First Energy, what you will eventually see on a really hot day or a really cold day, we will start to experience rolling blackouts similar to what happened in California back in the early 2000s because there was utility companies out there manipulating the price of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's interesting along that same line is the state of Ohio, their equivalent to our PUC, just levied a $43 million judgment against First Energy for, and I'm not exactly sure what the terminology would be, but I'll say this in a layperson's way, from kind of manipulating the price of electricity with some facets of their business out there. So, we're really concerned about service reliability and to our communities. Not only that, there's going to be a tremendous economic impact if both of these power stations are allowed to close. You have 182 workers that are effectively going to be laid off and put out into the street right now is what the company is basically telling us. And there's a lot of spinoff business that comes from the power station, trucking, coal, obviously, and so on and so forth.
Well, I know that Governor Corbett jumps up and down when he's able to brag about bringing 10 jobs to Pennsylvania.
Well, it's interesting because, we reached out to Governor Corbett's office. We wanted to meet with him to personally express some of our concerns about closing Armstrong Power Station, and actually we could not seem to get a meeting with him. We did get a meeting with some of his lower-level folks, and it was interesting. During that meeting, they said, well, even though they realized the state of Pennsylvania allowed companies like First Energy to close every power station that they own, they would never allow that to happen. So basically what I would tell you is pretty much if they close Hatfield and Mitchell Power Station, First Energy is going to primarily be out of the generating business in western Pennsylvania and the old Allegheny Energy area.
And they could crash these like they crashed that other one.
Absolutely. In fact, they're telling us the Mitchell Power Station, they fully intend to destroy it the day they shut it down. And the Hatfield Power Station, we're not quite sure what the plan is for that. We're still trying to actually figure that out from them. They've kind of given us some information that they might have it ready to run in some period of time, but the information's been very sketchy. So I'm not sure how to commit to that one way or the other today, but that's one of the questions that we're still pursuing to find out what's going to take place.
You know, this is just so discouraging. I'm writing a book about the labor history movement in the United States, and it's titled Daddy, What's a Middle Class? And it's as though nobody in leadership, no matter what political party you're talking about or any political level, whether it's federal or state or, seems to notice that they are, or care, I'm sure they must notice, that they are literally setting all of this up for a dismantling and complete disillusion of the middle class.
I couldn't disagree with you more. Yeah, but here's a couple key factors for you related to the power station piece, and not to switch gears away from your book, but both of these stations, Hatfield can run until 2016 with no investment or modifications to the plant, and Mitchell can run until 2015 with no investment or modifications to the plant. So the question you have to ask is, why would you take them offline now if they're cost effective, and you keep coming back to that one single answer? It's to artificially raise the price of electricity.
Right, so, and when will they take them off? Have they given a date?
They're telling us that no later than October 9th they plan to shut them down.
Holy cow, that's like 5 weeks from now. So what can people do? People hearing you right now who are like, this is insanity. I haven't heard anything about this in the mainstream media. Oh, by the way, I haven't. We are mainstream media. We're a regular broadcast radio show, but this is the first one I've heard about it.
Well, I'm hoping that this will be a springboard into that and that we can get this out there into the forefront. Not only does this affect the economy of all these states that we operate in and the ratepayers of the residential consumers of electricity, but there's another piece that's often forgotten. And if you think about it, electricity powers everything that there is out there today. It's a key component in business, national security, and everything. Without it, once the lights go out and you're in the dark for 2 or 3 days, you really start to realize just how critical it is.
Well, they certainly learned that when Katrina hit in New Orleans. They've learned that in the war zones that we've been involved in. No power is a big problem.
Sure. Yeah, but there's a simple answer to this in my mind. And we need to start contacting our state legislators, our U.S. Representatives, and tell them, look, utilities need to be regulated. They're there for everybody's use. They should be cost-effective. They should be accessible to everybody. And they should be allowed to make a profit. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because First Energy cites some of the EPA rules and stuff as part of the reason why they want to close these plants. And instead of putting investments into these power stations, they went out and tried to lobby to have the rules changed so that they wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah.
Now, you know, one of the analogies I like to use is a long time ago when I was a young man, I had a 1969 Camaro. It was one of the first General Motors products that had a pollution pump on it. Uh-huh. I'm sure General Motors didn't want to put a pollution pump, especially on that model of car.
Right.
But you fast forward to today, it's just a normal part of every car. What comes out of the tailpipe is cleaner, much more efficient gas mileage, and even better performance out of the vehicle, sports car like that. So, yeah, if we would start investing in the technology and the power station to start trying to clean up the air, clean up the water, we'll get better at it. It will become more cost-effective. But the only way you're going to require that is if a state like Pennsylvania is regulates utilities again and takes control of that situation where they can mandate to utilities that you must invest back in these stations to have safe, reliable, clean electric.
Bob Whalen, if you were First Energy, you would have taken that car and pushed it right off a cliff. I'm not having that regulation. I'm going to just destroy it now. Hey, Bob Whalen, sorry that we had to cut time a little short tonight. I hope we can get you back on the show real soon and we can talk about some more issues that are pending. And is there a website that people can go to forward on to their legislator so that they'll know something about?
One of the best websites to go to right now is the Utility Workers Union of America website. It's a national website or national that has a lot of current up-to-date information on those issues and others that are important to working families and also to business owners. I mean, this is going to be a huge impact if companies like First Energy are allowed to get away with doing this. So
we'll put a link to that on our website as well. Bob Whalen, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Have a great evening. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I'm Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith. We're going to take a quick break and talk about food justice when we get back. Come right up.
With its merger taking off, American Airlines' swashbuckling PR slogan proclaimed, "Two great airlines, one great future." That wasn't about its present attempt to merge with U.S. Airways, but about its 2001 takeover of TWA. Since then, American's honchos have relentlessly cut flights, jacked up fees, fired thousands of excellent employees, turned flying into a misery, and plunged the high-flying corporation into bankruptcy. Some great future. Now, American wants to take the same route by hooking up with U.S. Air, again proclaiming that the combination will be great. But for whom? Not for passengers. In July, Consumer Reports magazine revealed that American and U.S. Air were tied for ninth worst out of 11 big airlines in a survey of customer satisfaction. Two bad performers won't add up to a good one. Indeed, the combined entity looks to be so bad for the flying public that even the toothless antitrust watchdogs of the Justice Department are at least barking at this merger, having filed suit to block it. If the two join, only four giants would control nearly 90% of U.S. flights. Well, snapped the oligopolist, that's just how the free market works. Yeah, as in free to gouge. From its earliest days, this industry has been heavily subsidized and protected, and the last thing its bureaucratic profiteers want is actually having to compete with each other. They haven't become giants by being agile competitors for customer loyalty, but by dividing up the market, colluding on price hikes, cutting amenities, and slashing service. Their only area of real competition is in the annual race to see which airline CEO gets the fattest paycheck.
This is Jim Hightower saying, if this merger goes through, get ready for the big four to merge into two, and then the two becomes one, all in the name of free market competition. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's a fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as tomorrow. Let's save some fun tomorrow.
Oh, who cares about our kids and grandkids? Those seven generations of respect that the native tribes speak of. Who needs that? You know what? People who are hungry today, they're irritating too. Why should they get fed just because some church thinks that it would be a nice thing to do? Well, the police can go and hassle those churches and say, nope, I'll tell you what food justice looks like. Looks like three hots and a cot for you. You want to go to jail? That's where we're going to put you, Reverend Father, Rabbi, Omam, Imam. Joining me right now, Betsy Gerald, who, hey, Betsy, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Hope, so glad you're here, because the fact that I'm speaking gibberish all evening is going to be okay with you.
Brett told me you were having a hard night, sweetie.
This man,
we'll get through
I don't know if he did. I hope not. I've got to get somebody who will get a hold of whatever hospital they took him to, but some poor fellow, he fell from the bus.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He split his head open, and it was the bloodiest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, scalp wounds bleed.
Oh, it was awful. Anyway, so hopefully the man is fine. The bus driver was heroic. The people were heroic. Of course, a nurse was the best. She just ran up and started asking really smart questions like, what drugs is he on? Is he on a blood thinner?
Ooh,
like,
yeah.
Really smart questions, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well.
But you know that because you're a nurse.
So,
Betsy, talk to me about, first of all, this first story I spoke of in Texas, but it's happening all across the country where they've made it illegal to feed the poor.
Right, yeah. Well, they're trying to make it illegal for us to feed ourselves. That is what they're aiming for. It really is. It's getting, you know, the organization that I work with, we do a lot around local food sovereignty issues and being able to feed yourself and your neighbors and not have the feds come in or even the state come in and say, you know, no, you cannot sell raw milk to your neighbors. Or no,
well, that's,
you know,
happening right now. I mean, that was the front page story in the Carlisle Sentinel yesterday about raw milk.
Yeah, I read it. Yeah.
And that had been going on in Maine, too. And all across the country. Raw milk? I mean.
I know. It's
not crack, right?
It's not crack. In fact, I just a little anecdote. I've had Lyme disease this summer.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
And I have to say that the thing that got me through the worst of it when I really couldn't eat anything else.
Yeah.
Was my neighbor's raw milk.
And why was that? Is there a...
It's so much healthier for you. It's got all the enzymes that you need. It hasn't been processed. I mean, processed foods, our bodies are built to process the food. Thank you very much. Just feed it to us.
Oh, we're a processing plant.
We're a processing plant. Yes, the FDA will be trying to regulate us next. My stomach is next on their radar.
That's awfully tiny. okay, so... I hope you're feeling better, by the way. But
oh, I am. Thank you. Yes.
So the other thing that we have in central Pennsylvania, like by the truckload, are farmers.
Yeah.
And every farmer in the state of Pennsylvania has to have a conservation plan. Every farmer and it has to be registered. Every farmer in the state of Pennsylvania has to have a plan for how they're going to, you know, what they're going to do with the waste from animals, mm-hmm. all these things. I mean, it's so exhausting to even think of being a farmer and then to think of the paperwork they have. But that's good. You don't want stuff running off into groundwater and doing other things.
This is the thing. It's not the small farmers who are polluting the streams with their hog farms. Okay. It's the big industrial feedlot farms that are causing all, you know.
Right, those eight, when I was traveling out west, the miles of animals that you can't see a space between them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the piece of the agricultural industry that has the loud lobbying voice, and they're the ones who get the regulations written to help them.
Well, you know, if we genetically modify the food, we won't really need your stomach anymore.
See, now that's probably, I'm sure Monsanto is working on that. I think you're probably absolutely right. I spent this past Monday, the 19th, sitting in the Augusta Armory, face-to-face with Mr. Monsanto himself, Michael Taylor, who is the deputy commissioner for the FDA.
They were up in. How is he? Is he all right? Is he on life support?
He scares the poop out of me. I don't know.
Yeah, I have a compost plan for that.
Yeah. Well, he's just. I mean, you talk about the revolving door of
lobbyists. Now, wait a minute. Now, did you get to speak to him? Did you get to ask him questions?
I got to stand up at the microphone and say to him, "What the heck are you doing asking farmers to come in on a beautiful haymaking August morning to spend 4 hours telling you that the regulations you've written for the Food Safety Modernization Act are bogus and are going to put us out of business and are going to eat up the very, very slim margin of profit that small farmers live on?"
Yeah, average farmer's disposable income, small farmer disposable income, $5,000 a year.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, they eat really well.
Yeah.
As long as they're allowed to eat the foods that they're producing.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to come down to that. But what happened to us in Maine over the raw milk issue is that there was a farmer down on the peninsula, down in Blue Hill.
Farmer Brown.
Yes, Farmer Brown.
Yeah.
Dan Brown. Good guy. Good guy. Milking one cow, selling it to his neighbors. The state came in, didn't even tell them. He was like a lot of farmers do, you just go into their farm stand and open up the refrigerator and take what you want and leave the money, you know, you know, on farm sale.
And by the way, nobody steals the money, but also nobody steals everybody else's money.
Right.
Like eight people will leave $3 there, and there's $24 there at the end.
Yeah.
So, Betsy, the big question, though, is we only have a couple of minutes, and I apologize for the day being so crazy.
That's all right, Sadie. I'm sorry you had it.
Yeah, so I'm not made for that. The question is, we had a man on before you who works at a utility plant saying, please regulate these utilities. We need regulation. We need energy regulation. We need utilities to be regulated. We need the big farms to be regulated. We need the seed mass production agri Frankenfoods people regulated. We need regulation, you know. I mean, I could add your voice to his voice. There are a lot more of us than there are of them.
Yeah.
They have a lot more money.
Well, I agree that the big farms need to be regulated because it's the big farms that are killing people with their tainted spinach.
Right,
it's
and their bad eggs. And their,
you know, whatever, all horrible, you know, their tainted meat. But I'll just say to your listeners what Nan Kennedy said at the hearings the other day. She says, you know what we figured out in Maine? If you poison your neighbors or you kill your customers, you don't do any more business.
Yeah, they take exception to that.
Right. And so face-to-face small farm sales do not need to be regulated or not as heavily regulated as the FDA is talking about regulating.
I was interviewing a migrant farmer when we were out. Where were we? I think we were in Toledo. Brett, Toledo, we had migrant farmers we were interviewing. And one guy said that while he was picking his crops, which, you know, stoop back, broke, blistering heat, South Carolina, picking his crops, they had water, you know, for the workers, thankfully. Mm. And they came by and pesticided the crops while they were there and pesticided their water supply. These are the guys who need it. These are the guys who need somebody to say, you know, Archer Daniels, Midland, Monsanto, the rest of you.
And there are good organizations out there working with farm workers, Food for Maine's Future being one, CIW being another, the Coalition of Maliki Workers that did the pound a penny for penny a pound for tomatoes to increase the mm-hmm. pay for the people who are picking our tomatoes. But, this, you know, I guess the point I want to make is that everybody thinks that it's all foodies buying local organic food. And, you know, to some extent it is. But we could feed everybody and feed them well and feed them for not a lot of money if people were just willing to spend a little bit more of their disposable income for food.
For food, right. Betsy, can I have you back on when I haven't had such a crazy day and we can talk some more about this?
I was just thinking of all the other roads that we could travel down in this chat. Yes,
yeah.
Anytime.
I had a whole pile of thoughts that were somewhat organized at 5 o'clock that were scrambled completely by 8 p.m. But, yeah, we'll have you back on. We'll talk some more about it. Betsy Gerald, thank you so much for taking some time tonight.
Sure, sure. You have a better day.
Thank you. And, you know, my day compared to that poor old man's day is fabulous. So, and I'm very fortunate that there were so many wonderful first responders there. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith, and we'll be right back with more of the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Port truck drivers at Green Fleet Systems in Los Angeles are calling a one-day strike protesting what they say is anti-union harassment and intimidation from the company. The Teamsters are helping the drivers to organize. The Teamsters say unfair labor practice charges were filed with the NLRB alleging the harassment by Green Fleet and its hired union busters. The unfair labor practice strike will include picketing and a large rally complete with Teamsters big rigs rolling up at the port to support the strike. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says drivers who should be employees are instead being treated like independent contractors.
They're made to pay for everything, for the fuel, for new tires, all the business expenses that the companies that they work for should be paying is passed on to these drivers. And even the few drivers who are employees and have some rights are really, you know, can't make ends meet, have no paid time off, no health insurance. And so drivers are fed up.
Weiner says the Teamsters had an organizing victory earlier this year at ports in Los Angeles and New Jersey. Labor community leaders and Washington, D.C. City Council members today are calling on Washington's mayor to sign the Large Retailer Accountability Act. The act calls for giant retailers with more than $1 billion annual revenue and stores of 75,000 square feet or more to pay workers at least $12.50 an hour plus benefits. Supporters of the act say it's a fair deal for a living wage. The event is part of the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. University of Miami custodians could soon be walking the picket lines. Jesse Russell reports.
The workers vote in favor of strike action if an agreeable contract can't be reached by August 31st. The custodial workers are unhappy with a proposed 10-cent raise, as many of the workers only earn $8.55 per hour. The university contracts with DTZ Incorporated, who provides custodial workers. So far, the school has chosen to not get involved with negotiations. The custodial staff at the university also went on strike in 2006 for 9 weeks. They were demanding that they be allowed to organize. Most of the custodial staff is represented by the Service Employees International Union.
Strike action continues to spread in South Africa. Strikes that began at gold mines and in the automobile manufacturing sector have now spread to airports and construction sites. Nearly 200,000 workers have downed tools in the nation, and in all cases, the workers are seeking better wages. Combined, the industries account for 15% of South Africa's economy.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need a third party to save this country. Not Ron Paul and the Ron Paulites. No, we need a legitimate third party to challenge the current system that we have.
because I don't believe that the Republican Party, although I ran as a Republican, I have been voting Republican for decades, I don't believe the Republican Party has the ability to rebrand itself.
Herman Cain, the best president I got in 2012, Herman Cain. Who needs anything else when you're a political talk radio host? And you ride in a morning show. I was doing a morning show in Maine working for Stephen King. And Herman Cain's mistress, Ginger White, my favorite person on the planet, comes out and says, "The sex was awful, but the money was good." You should have paid her more, Herman. Maybe she'd have kept her mouth shut. But, you know, he said we need a third party. I got a little news for him. We've got some. One of my favorite third parties is the Libertarian Party. I am a member of the Green Party, which would be another one of my favorite third parties. It happens to be the one I belong to. And it's always fun for me when I get to interview another person that is labeled a radical, a malcontent, somebody who just can't understand. You know, that's what we are, James. We're naive. You're too naive to understand how this works. Now just get back in line in one of the major political parties, and then we can all go to war with Syria on Thursday. James Babb is a libertarian activist in Philadelphia. He is founder of We Won't Fly. Did you invent that, James?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We Won't Fly is a marvelous idea for people who desire dignity and personal liberty. Because your organization says don't submit to basically being felt up electronically or physically by TSA and their machines.
Exactly right.
WeWon'tFly.com. Now, have you actually been able to board a plane even though you refuse to be? Trust me, I do people a favor when I wear clothes. It's not just my modesty, it's for your health and well-being. So, I mean, have you actually been allowed to board a plane when you said, I'm not going to be subjected to that?
Well, I have not tried to. I feel it's too dangerous. So I have not attempted since they put the nude scanners, I call them the porno scanners, in the airports. I do not, have not been to the airport. I have not attempted to go through there. It doesn't mean I won't ever, but for now I've been able to avoid it. I had to drive to Minnesota once from Philadelphia. That was kind of a little bit of a long, it was actually a train ride. I didn't drive, but it was a long, long trip not flying. It's very inconvenient not to fly. Yeah. But
luckily we still have a few trains, though, because the trains are wonderful. Now, you're a domestic extremist, you've been called. I ran for vice president of the United States in 2004 for the Greens. And, you know, after you fly 50 or 60 times in 2 months, you start to develop friendships with the people who were searching you, you know. It's like, hey, how are you doing? Yeah, well, a little easier on the butt this time. Okay, fine. You know, and I flew a lot of places one way, which I guess shows you're a terrorist, you know, like a terrorist can't afford a round-trip ticket. So I was always getting extra searches because, you know, I'd fly into one state, travel through a bunch of states, and fly home, you know, running for office. And I would make jokes and say, you know, can we play, like, TSA strip poker? You know, can I get your belt next time? You know. Me just coughing up my clothes is a little, there's no sport in that, you know. But this is, I don't believe it's done to keep us safe. I think it's done to feed the fear. And it's a lot easier to control people that are afraid.
Well, that's certainly part of the equation, no doubt about that. I mean, what has been proven to be the case over and over again, that what they're doing is security theater. Even the people that created the TSA, like Congressman John Micah, he was calling it a big kabuki dance, what they're doing. And he acts like, oh, I didn't know. I just created the monster. I didn't know it was going to, you know, walk around terrorizing everybody.
My favorite part about the creation of the TSA is that was all private enterprise. That was all individual businesses that had been hired by airports as security, and they got nationalized. And they took all this private business, small business, And they nationalized it and made one big government agency out of it, and the Republicans did that.
Well, I guess I'm not sure what stage you're referring to. I mean, airport security, the FAA had sort of nationalized the whole process long ago.
But they still had private companies providing it. They just adhered to the regulations.
Yeah, but when they created the TSA, they ended up hiring like 67,000 people.
Yeah.
And many of these had never worked in this industry before. They had to advertise on pizza boxes to get enough
More Herman Cain.
And so it's not like they really, they didn't have time for background checks. They didn't, They just had to fill those blue shirts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, personally, I don't really think, to me, the problem with the TSA is not the qualifications, it's not the training they receive, but it's just a simple violation of our individual rights. I don't think there is a proper training they can receive that will show them the right way to put their hands in a child's pants,
mm-hmm.
for instance. I just don't think it's appropriate.
Yeah.
There's not an appropriate way to make a person with a prosthetic leg take it off and have them hobble through a scanner that's going to take nude photographs of them.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a matter of training. It's just a matter of respect for individual rights, which are being completely violated through their procedures.
Now,
so,
I love The Next Generation, Star Trek The Next Generation, and you've ticked off Whoopi Goldberg. She says that you are, you have committed an act of terrorism by telling people that they should refuse to be electronically felt up.
I guess she wasn't really paying attention to the lessons from Star Trek The Next Generation. ironically, she thinks that, by defending individual rights and privacy, that constitutes an act of terrorism. But, yet have you seen Sister Act 2? I mean, who's the terrorist here?
Hey, wait a minute. That's a Catholic church. Pick one. But, okay, so now we're talking about personal liberty and stuff, and I want to move you. This is really fun for me, I just have to disclose that. I've had a rough evening, but this is really fun for me because this is hit the libertarian with a million questions. And I would just like to say, if I had a libertarian for president right now, I would have half of everything I want. Right now I have about none. I would have half of everything I want. I wouldn't have people telling me what to do with my body. I'm absolutely certain there wouldn't be a transvaginal ultrasound ever, unless I might have cancer, and I agreed to the test. I would have these draconian drug laws. Half of the people that are in jail right now would be out, and our expenses for prisons would be significantly reduced. We wouldn't have the Afghanistan war. We wouldn't have what looks like might be war in Syria on Thursday. I get nothing right now. If I had a libertarian, I would get at least half of what I want. And why that whole idea of personal liberty and respecting the Constitution and all that is maligned is beyond me.
It doesn't really suit the needs of those in power.
Oh, yeah.
How much control do you get if you believe that people own themselves, it's rather difficult to rule over them. So there's a little bit of consistency there.
Well, make a good point, because obviously the monarchs, that's one of the reasons that the United Kingdom can't be in the European Union, is because they won't take the Queen and her subjects off of the passports.
Well,
it's just a little more honest than the United States, where it's the United States and their subjects.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't choose to be a subject, and I don't want to. I don't want to be subservient to anyone. I don't want to be. I just don't want to be in that role. I don't think you should be in that role. I don't think anybody should be in that role, because a libertarian, I believe that everyone owns themselves, and that you have a right to be left alone as long as you're not interfering with someone else's individual rights.
Right.
So, and that's
so what
just,
do you think about Chelsea Manning?
I support Chelsea 100%. I mean, what a courageous person.
Yeah.
I just think it's so sad what has happened to her, and And what she's been through, it's just, it's heartbreaking. You know, I have a sign on my Facebook account that says jailbreak Chelsea Manning. I'm not going to even lobby to pardon her. Somebody should just go in there and break her out. I mean, that's what she deserves.
Yeah.
And she should get a parade immediately.
Yeah. I wrote an alternate, the other day offering to do a year of her sentence. I also invited President Obama to do a year of it, but then I remembered he should be doing a sentence for his own. But I just feel as though if people want to insist the stupidity of the military protocol has to be respected, then let me take a year and let Chelsea go. Because, as you said, the courage to tell us about collateral murder, the collateral murders that went on, the collateral murder video, to get all that stuff out to us. And I hope that she didn't think that she was going to be sending it to a grateful nation, because that's got to be heartbreaking.
Well, she did send it to a grateful nation. I think that the people that are aware are extremely appreciative of what she's done. It's just it's the people in power are not.
Yeah.
You know, the ruling class is not pleased with that for obvious reasons. You know, I wish the things had gone differently. I wish that these leaks had come out, but she didn't get caught.
Yeah.
To the next whistleblower out there, you don't have to go that way.
Right. Now,
you know,
we're talking to James Babb, libertarian Philadelphia dude. I just want to get that out there real quick. Now, how about Edward Snowden?
You know, so proud of you know what he's been able to release. I think, you know, any whistleblower really needs to be respected and honored. I might encourage the next person to try to learn and, you know what, maybe get that parallel life started before you before you release the Glenn Greenwald interview, you know, or find a way to do it, but stay in place and keep the leaks going. I fear, just because I fear for Snowden's safety, I don't know if he's, you know, I don't know how much danger he's in, but I suspect he's in quite a bit of danger. So,
yeah, I mean, I have said repeatedly on this program, he ran up on stage and pulled the United States pants down. And some of those people you're talking about in charge, they get awful cranky about that sort of thing. They don't mind pulling your pants down at the TSA stuff.
Well,
but you don't,
not,
you don't
right?
do it back.
Everything that you and I do must be completely transparent. Every financial transaction, every inch of our body at the airport, everything about our lives must be monitored and carefully scrutinized by them. But as soon as you start asking questions about what they're doing and shine a little light on their little racket, oh, now you've crossed the line. Now we're going to come get you. And by the way, you know, what you said we did, we didn't do, but because you told them that we did it, we have to kill you now. I mean, I think that's kind of where we're at with him right now. They're still denying that what he said was true, but because he released a state secret, they're going to have to get him. So,
oh, that's an excellent point. You said we did something. We actually didn't do it. But because you said we did it, now you're in trouble because you said we did it, but we didn't do it. Well, that would be like someone saying that I had robbed a bank, but I didn't rob the bank. And then why do I have to – the line that the government uses on us all the time, if you don't have anything to hide, why do you care?
Well, obviously there's somewhat of a double standard there.
And they have something to hide. Both of those things happen. You know, and I can't stand the why, if you have got anything to hide, why do you care thing? Because it's my privacy. Because the fact that I don't have anything to hide is just as private as if I had something to hide.
But if it keeps us safe, isn't it worth it?
You know, I love that. And I don't remember who said it. Maybe everybody said it. Maybe you said it. But the line that was fed to us was, they don't like us because of our freedoms. You know, they don't like us because of our way of life in the United States and our freedoms. And then we started surrendering freedoms, you know, as fast as we could.
Well, some of us aren't surrendering them. You know, we're at least hanging on to what's left and trying to cling to our remaining freedoms and restore those that have been lost.
Now, how about Syria? The bombs are going to start falling now. We hear Thursday morning, probably. just 1,000-pound ones, though, so that probably won't kill any innocent people.
Well, right. Because I forget exactly what the excuse is, but presumably somebody might have used a weapon of mass destruction on civilians. Therefore, we must use even more weapons of mass destruction on more civilians.
Thank you.
Immediately. Yeah, there's a lot of logic there, sure.
Well, you know, when you want to talk about baby killers, the United States of America. And, by the way, it was just a couple of months ago we had on this program the fact that of Western countries, we're like one of the top for having our babies die the day after they're born.
Well, remember what Madeleine Albrecht said when she was questioned about the 500,000 deaths of Iraqi children during sanctions under Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you know, the reports say 500,000, you know, children died because of what you guys did. You know, do you feel that was worth it? And Madeleine Albrecht says with a straight face, well, it was a hard choice, but yeah, we think it was worth it. Okay, 500,000 children. Now, and then they say, well, look, but that's not why anybody hates the U.S. government. No.
Yeah.
No.
It's the drone bombings.
Yeah, no, they don't care about that either. Their only problem is they hate us. And the fact that Ronald Reagan gave, helped Saddam Hussein get gas to use on the Iranians, don't pay attention to that either. They hate us because they hate us. That's all. That's all you need to think about.
So, I think Howard Zinn said that the only reason way to be a truly imperialist nation is to have the third world at home. And so is that the whole plan of the destruction of the middle class and all the rest of that, is the fact that if we're still worried about how to feed little Billy, we're not going to really care who we blow up in another country.
Well, that certainly could be a factor. Or are they blowing up abroad to keep us in control at home? I think there's sort of a flip side of the coin. It's like, do they manipulate the currency the way they do, inflate the currency to pay for wars, or do they go to war to have an excuse to inflate the currency? And rip us all off.
And eventually it really doesn't matter, because that cyclical reality is just happening. So it really doesn't matter how it started. What matters is how can we stop it?
Well, and that is a key question. And, you know, I'm still excited about, you know, there's certain things about this age that we live in that are absolutely astounding and amazing. As crazy as they're getting, first of all, I think more and more people are becoming aware of how ridiculous and illegitimate these people are. People are just openly laughing. Now, it might not be what you see on ABC News or CNN, mm-hmm. but I think the legitimacy is totally in the toilet. So to me, that's a good thing. When people aren't taking it seriously, I like that. I think that's a step in the right direction. The information age has given us amazing tools.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can have a TV station now through YouTube.
Right.
Anybody can publish their ideas across the world in seconds. There's been never anything like this in the history of the world.
Yeah.
So we have the power of information, and that can't be stopped.
People to act on it, though? How do we get people to, I mean, they're going to bomb Syria Thursday. James, right now I want you to give us the secret to how we can stop that.
It's all
on your shoulders right now, buddy.
Well, you know, first thing I'll do is give a message out to anybody that's a military employee right now. And that message is, go AWOL now. Quit. Walk away. That's going to take courage. Okay? Now, you people, because then you know it's wrong. So if you're in the service, go ahead and walk away right now. Just quit. There's people willing to help you and will stand with you and side by side with you, and just know that, you know, it's not cowardice to run away from this. It is one of the most courageous things you would ever do in a military career right now.
Absolutely.
Is to just put down the gun, walk away, say, no, I'm not going to do it. Because when people say they're not going to go to war, the war is over.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing Hillary Clinton can do about it if people won't pull the trigger or drop the bomb on those families.
Well, you know, we had the guys on from the Los Alamos study group, And they're just watchdogs for the nuclear silos around the world. And there's going to be another $500 billion spent on new nuclear weapons for the United States, even though we signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which makes us the chief violators of the treaty. But that's the other thing. I mean, these guys are in basement holes with little keys to turn. Why would anyone go to work on that job?
A good question. And certainly there's better jobs for these people. And I would say to people, like, look, if they say, well, look, I can't quit. I've got my family to feed. You're right. I don't want to do this job. It's immoral. It's wrong. It's evil. But what do I do? I'd say, you know what? Stay. You know what? Maybe lose those little keys. Oops. Yeah. What happened? I don't know.
Yeah, eat the key.
You know, you don't need those, you know, lose the keys to the armory, monkey wrench stuff. You got a shipment of weapons going somewhere? Send it somewhere else. Stay in place, be a monkey wrencher.
Is this sedition?
Yes.
And, you know, that's exactly what was committed by George Washington. That's when he sat in Froucher's Tavern or whatever in Lower Manhattan and planned the battles with the British, it was sedition. And everybody thinks he's just like the best thing since somebody wrote him on the dollar bill.
Well, I think there's a solid argument to say, you know, gosh, you know, yeah, the British rule seems somewhat tyrannical. I think it was like a 3% tax on a breakfast drink. Whoa. You know, let's
into the harbor with you.
Yeah, we're go to war over that one, you know, and the threat of harboring troops. Well, they might quarter troops in our house. You know, now they just take everything you own and build a barracks in your town. They don't care.
I am writing down while you're talking 3% tax on a breakfast drink. That is the best thing I've heard in a long, long time. James, this is an absolute treat. I hope that we can get you back on the show often just to spew all things libertarian because, man, it's refreshing and fun and exciting, and I hope that everybody who heard you say don't go to work tomorrow doesn't go.
Well, it's easy to do, and whether you're in the Army or working for the State Department or really any government branch, just start being a monkey wrencher. Just because history is going to look back and remember you, and you can decide what side you're on. You can be on the side that helped go to war. You can be on the side that plundered the American people, or you could be on the side that said, you know what, I'm gonna maybe I'll be, you know, the new Schindler. I'm gonna help people escape this tyranny. I'm gonna do what I can from the inside. People can make that choice.
Put a whoopee cushion on your boss's chair, especially if he's got 5 stars. Wait for him to have a seat. Hey, James, thanks so much for taking the time joining us on the Rick Smith Show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. James Babb, libertarian activist and all-around renegade. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick, and we'll be back with more of the Rick Smith Show coming up. Rick.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Port truck drivers at Green Fleet Systems in Los Angeles are calling a one-day strike protesting what they say is anti-union harassment and intimidation from the company. The Teamsters are helping the drivers to organize. The Teamsters say unfair labor practice charges were filed with the NLRB alleging the harassment by Green Fleet and its hired union busters. The unfair labor practice strike will include picketing and a large rally complete with Teamsters big rigs rolling up at the port to support the strike. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says drivers who should be employees are instead being treated like independent contractors.
They're
made to pay for everything, for the fuel, for new tires, all the business expenses that the companies that they work for should be paying is passed on to these drivers. And even the few drivers who are employees and have some rights are really, you know, can't make ends meet, have no paid time off, no health insurance. And so drivers are fed up.
Wiener says the Teamsters had an organizing victory earlier this year at ports in Los Angeles and New Jersey. Labor community leaders and Washington, D.C. City Council members today are calling on Washington's mayor to sign the Large Retailer Accountability Act. The act calls for giant retailers with more than $1 billion annual revenue and stores of 75,000 square feet or more to pay workers at least $12.50 an hour plus benefits. Supporters of the act say it's a fair deal for a living wage. The event is part of the commemoration the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. University of Miami custodians could soon be walking the picket lines, Jesse Russell reports.
The workers voted in favor of strike action if an agreeable contract can't be reached by August 31st. The custodial workers are unhappy with a proposed 10, as many of the workers only earn $8.55 per hour. The university contracts with DTZ Incorporated, who provides custodial workers. So far, the school has chosen to not get involved with negotiations. The custodial staff at the university also went on strike in 2006 for 9 weeks. They were demanding that they be allowed to organize. Most of the custodial staff is represented by the Service Employees International Union.
Strike action continues to spread in South Africa. Strikes that began at gold mines and in the automobile manufacturing sector have now spread to airports and construction sites. Nearly 200,000 workers have downed tools in the nation, and in all cases, the workers are seeking better wages. Combined, the industries account for 15% of South Africa's economy.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
My throat on the radio. How incredibly unprofessional and just in keeping with the rest of the program tonight. Oh, dear Lord. This is Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith probably for the last time in my life. If he's listening, sorry, Rick, and for the rest of you, it was nice knowing you. And it's been quite an evening. It started out with this terrible accident with the bus I was on. Man, no, it's been taken to the hospital. I don't know how he is, but it was just kind of, I don't know, scrambled my brains. I wrote a note about it called I Love the Bus Driver, this bus driver, and I'll put that up on the Rick Smith page so that you can read the crazy story and I don't have to tell anybody it again. But it has been quite an evening, and thanks to having so many wonderful guests, hopefully the show has still been worth hanging in there for, because my next guest is another one of those fabulous guests you're not going to want to have missed just because I destroyed a program. Steve McManus is actually an old buddy of mine, an old high school friend, and just an amazing person who I've turned to for all kinds of information over the years, especially the last few years, as he has had his own regular podcast called Forbidden America, and he now is also CEO, general manager of the Illuminati Network. What's your title, Steve? Help me here. I'm floundering.
What are you out there? You're causing trouble, and the NSA people are trying to kill you on your bus, the whole bit.
Is that what it was? I never even thought of that. Here, take my peanut butter and jelly. You can have anything I own. It's just, since I broke my phone, basically, is the sandwich. Steve, welcome to the Rick Smith Show, by the way.
Hey, it's good to be here. I do a live show called Forbidden America once a week on Monday nights at 8 Eastern. And then that is one of the many shows that are featured on the Illuminati Network at the illuminatinetwork.com. And we do lots of alternative programming over there. that is designed to inform you and enlighten you and kind of raise the vibration.
And there's a lot of spirituality on that website.
Is.
And so for people who feel like they're really spiritual people, and I got to tell you something, when I was holding this man's head as he was bleeding into the gutter tonight, and if it's possible for people to have appeared out of vapor, that's what it felt like. The man who handed me rubber gloves, the nurse who all of a sudden appeared. I mean, I know she must have walked up, but I was so entranced in just holding this man that I didn't notice her until she said, "I'm a nurse. I'll get my kit. Is he on any medicine? Is he on blood thinners?" You know, really smart questions. Mm-hmm. You know, we're waiting for the ambulance to arrive, and it felt pretty spiritual. It did not feel like I was on the planet alone. It felt like, and it didn't feel like he was on the planet alone either, because when I first went down to help him, he just stared at my face and he looked so frightened, which he must have been. I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen bleeding like this. And as the man who appeared, who gave me the rubber gloves, tried to hold this man's head, the blood was just like bubbling over his hand. You know, and so I'm holding this man's hand, I'm holding his head, and at first he looked at me really frightened, but then he like squeezed my hand and looked at me really confident. You know, and I thought, I'm in love with this man right now. I don't know what other feeling I'm feeling, but I'm feeling really like I want to cradle this man and protect him and save him from whatever's happening to him. And that can't just be two humans that bump into each other on the street and one of them's banged their head.
Right. Yeah. What the big thing that's happening there overall is that you're making that connection, and really it boils down to, do you see me? I could be leaving now, so I want to know before I go, do you see me?
And that's what I was feeling was, don't die. I'm like sending him this message in my brain.
Right. I had that same discussion about that same type of connection where I was having a discussion, and you know, I tend to lean a little left.
God love you.
Not in everything, but I tend to lean a little left. And I was having a discussion about the abortion issue with somebody who does not lean left at all. And stereotypes aside, they in fact do in fact say that, you know, abortion's straight up wrong and it's never okay. And I differ in that opinion. And I said, and they were talking to me about my network and about, you know, what are we about? You know, you have witches on that network. What the hell is that? And I'm talking about all those things. And I'm like, okay, here's the deal. Let me just spell it out for you. I said, when you think someone is, if you're all about Jesus and you're all about, you know, love your neighbor and all that kind of thing, and that's great. It's not, I'm not down in that at all. But if you're all about that and you think these other people that you're dealing with apparently aren't about that at all, I want you to consider one thing. And I'm saying this within the framework of the conversation about abortion. I said, here's this woman. And she has to go in here for health care issues, of among which may in fact well be an abortion. And here are all these people ranting and screaming and vehemently, they're at war with this situation and now with this woman. She has to run this gauntlet of hell to simply get health care. And you may not agree with her decision, and you may vehemently say, hell no, I don't want you to, you know, to kill this unborn child, blah, 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 the whole line of credit. We don't need to go into it. We know what it's all about. I said, but what if you realize that day, even if no one was there to greet her, even if all she was doing was showing up, you know, with no one there to yell at her, simply to get this procedure, it would probably still be the shittiest day of her life. So how about, instead of yelling and screaming at her, even though you don't agree with her decision, maybe just hold her hand and say, look, I don't agree with you, but I got your back, and it's okay, and I'll help you get through today.
And what did this person say? Because I don't think they want to hold the hand of a woman who's getting an abortion.
Well, what would Jesus do?
Well, what would Jesus do is one of the, we've been saying that all day, because right now a church was trying to feed, which is happening all across the country, trying to feed some hungry people and some homeless people, and the cops were hassling them.
And the cops were hassling them, yeah. Exactly. And you know, and I'm not a Christian by any stretch, but I mean, okay, so what, you're not a religious person. Pat LaMarche is not a religious person.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
I know that about you. And so, but here you are in the ditch with blood all over you. You don't care if this guy is fundamentalist Baptist or Al-Qaeda or whoever. It's just somebody that needs help.
Yeah, that's true. I never even thought about what his feelings might be on anything.
Don't care.
I didn't care.
All you want to do is look in his eyes, take care of the problem, make a connection with this individual.
You know, the best thing, you just, like, I'm having all these epiphanies while I'm talking to you, which is kind of your forte, but he didn't look at me like he cared either.
He didn't care who you are.
Yeah. He didn't care that I might be some tree-hugging hippie freak who wants to raise his taxes.
Yeah, exactly. And firefighters don't care. They run into that building. They don't ask you, what, are you Muslim? They don't care. They're just there to save your ass.
Yeah.
You know? And that's all you cared about is, like, I'm just here to help. All I want to do is help you.
Yeah. So.
There it is. That's what it's about.
Okay, so let's go on to the Illuminati Network. I don't think there are many people who think of a station where they can go and hear witches.
Right.
So what is this whole witch business, and do witches really need a forum?
Yeah, they do. The thing is that, you know, for centuries it was always the crazy old woman at the edge of the village, you know, who picked certain flowers and you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, she could either help you or kill you, you know.
Yeah. And lived long enough to have skin tags and other things that made her look like.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And me being a white Irish boy, I can't identify with that or anything. But anyway, you know, it's that whole background of we keep her at arm's length. She's over there at the edge. She's you know, half crazy. But boy, I'll tell you, when somebody gets sick, that's the first, on the down low, they will go and find her, see if she can help, you know, whatever. And then she always did. The people that hated her, she helped them anyway, because that's what she does. And those people are still alive. They're my friends.
So let's tell people what a witch is. Now, there are Wiccan, there are witches. Are these people in a cult?
There's some crazy mofos out there. They're not, I mean, just like any other group. I mean, you can have lots of wonderful Christian folks of various flavors who do wonderful work, like trying to feed the homeless, whether or not the police agree. And then there are other Christians who are simply bent on, you know, castigating people that they feel are.
Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah, like Westboro. You know, I don't see them as Christians. I see them as just plain up assholes. Crazy asshole, but anyway, so yeah, we the people in the pagan or and
we just had a technical difficulty, and we will be back with Steve in just a second. Brett is fixing our difficulty, and are we all better now?
We are all better now.
Yeah, sorry about that. So some people are. Some of the witches or Wiccans or what is the difference? Is a witch automatically Wiccan?
No. A Christian is not automatically a Catholic.
I see.
You can be any flavor of Christian. It depends on what denomination. And then there are witches who don't have a religion per se. They simply practice magic. Not magic like David Copperfield. Magic, like the manipulation of energy to bring about change in things.
Can they do something about Syria?
Actually, yes. That's been known to have happened. In fact, during World War II, which is in England, were said to have raised storms to affect the weather in order to change the course of the war.
You know, I have no faith in anything except maybe our potential to be good people. But I don't buy that any more than I buy the religion stuff. I mean, I guess this is another religion, and so if you have faith that, you know, there was a magic tree that had knowledge, or if you have the faith that, you know, Buddha had wandered for however long, if you have those faiths, that this is just another faith, but I'm just, I guess I don't see it. And so is the reason that a witch conjuring a storm to help the Royal Air Force,
mm-hmm.
is that harder for people to believe just because it's not as mainstream and legitimate as, you know, there was a tree with knowledge?
Harder for people to believe because they see it as more arrogant. They're like, well, no, why should I believe you when you say you can raise a storm? That's ludicrous, you know. But, I mean, if I tell you, for instance, if I say, well, I have the power, and I use the word power, let's use ability instead.
Okay.
I have the ability to see things that are not where I am. I can remotely see things.
Yeah.
Well, you know for a fact that I can do that.
Yeah, which you've done, yeah, which is pretty remarkable.
So there are other people who can do that, and many of them have been used by various governments, including the United States government, to do just that, to do remote viewing. Well, remote viewing was first brought to the United States government, for instance, by witches. And it became known to the government, oh, wait, people can do that kind of thing? Well, where do we find out more about that? And then there was when that project started, it started with the help of a group of witches that weren't necessarily Wiccan, because Wicca is a religion unto itself, and many, many Wiccans are not witches at all. They're simply nature worshippers. They helped instigate that program, which is still used today. The government says they don't use it anymore. But the government does a lot of things.
So, yeah, they say a lot of things. So we've got, you've got shows about Christianity also. You have witchcraft. You have Islam and Judaism. Do you have basically all the Buddhism? Do you have them all covered on your programming?
Well, we have whichever ones wish to be heard. We do have a program that's fairly universal in its reach, hence the name Universal Journeys. They cover Buddhism, they cover Catholicism, they cover various forms of religion and religious faith and practice. But there's also other shows on there like, fitness, weight loss, self-image, there's a show on there by a West Coast rapper who does positive message rap and does a talk show about why destructive messages in the hip-hop culture are helping to destroy a whole section of American culture and that he wants to put a stop to it. The amazing thing is that he's 20 years old.
Hmm.
So there's any number of shows. We're up to about 20 different shows now.
Now, if someone wanted to contact the Illuminati Network and get their program on there, is that something that you'll entertain, just a cold call?
Well, sure. They can go right to the site, and there's a link there that says, you want to be a host a radio show. And we listen to pretty much anything for a pitch, you know, as long as it's life-affirming and uplifting, and it's not we have a music channel on the network, and if it's music, we can put you over to the music side, and they can take care of you and so forth. But if you want to do talk radio, for instance, the Rick Smith Show, they said, hey, we'd like to carry ourselves on the Illuminati Network. Yeah, we can talk about that. We can put them right on there. So that's doable.
And it doesn't have to be about spirituality. It could be about anything.
And it could be about anything.
Now, is it the Illuminati, like the Illuminati of medieval, post-medieval times when it was the people who basically had the information?
The reason that we took that name is the logic was sort of along the same lines as when the homosexual community took back the word queer, and they named themselves Queer Nation. They took the word and put it in its proper context, queer meaning odd, as opposed to being a term of derision. And we took back Illuminati because it was in 1800, between 1750 and 1830. Adam Weishaupt was alive, and he was the one that started the original Illuminati. And basically, it was a clandestine organization that basically connected with various members of government and business and so forth. And his objective was to get them all to work together to change the way that government and business were operating so that they started to do more things for the people and not to the people.
He obviously didn't see Congressman Boehner in the future.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. And the thing is that, you know, that game hasn't changed. And so the people that found out about him were, in fact, based in Bavaria, which was very was like the hub of those that were connected in power. And they turned it around, and they took everything that he was saying and that his group was saying and then put it on them. So they took their own attributes, mm-hmm. put it on a jacket on them, like Adam Weishaupt and his compatriots, and said, it's them that's doing this. And then they took it to the public and, you know, beat them to the punch and said, see, these people are hiding in the shadows, and it's them. And the Illuminati, which is what Adam Weishaupt had named his group, you know, they're the ones that are, you know, that are making all these wars and doing all, and when in fact it was them.
Mm-hmm.
And so from then on, we refer to the evil people who, quote unquote, run the world, the unscrupulous profiteers, you know, of which there are about 800 today. There are 800 people that basically run the world, period. And they are all, it's like a cabal, and uh-huh. they run the world. They are the ones that tell governments what their policies are going to be and so on and so forth. And they are the ones that profit from everything.
So it's the Syrian mess just a big chess play by these people who run the world?
You better believe it. And everything that you see with regard to warfare and bloodshed and people to get caught in the middle, that is profit-driven.
Well, I don't doubt at all that this is about the military-industrial complex, and I don't doubt at all that it's about war without end, amen. I don't doubt that at all.
I mean, it's pretty simple math. If people are making $8 an hour, if the rank-and-file people are making $8 an hour, and somebody that makes $10 or $15 an hour, they think they're doing really well, and then you look at the cost indexes,
mm-hmm.
they're not doing well at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you're taught to think that any little crumb you get is enough, or it's even great.
Mm-hmm.
That's by design, but of course the less they give you, the more they make. Of course when they take their operation from one country and put it in a country where they can do it for, you know, one-sixth the cost, then they make that much more profit margin. Profit's not good enough. It's got to be this much profit.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's not by accident. And the war machine of the various, it's all for posturing, it's all for position, and it's all for profit. This is about money. Syria is about money. It's just money. Yeah, and the people.
Well, because you can't sell hollow point bullets. You can't sell uranium tipped weapons.
Right.
You can't
right.
sell this stuff if you don't have a war.
That's exactly right.
And then sell to all the sides.
The Syrian army right now are not the enemy. Syrian army has done everything in its power to protect the people that their neighbors. But some of the reports you see out there are that they are the problem and that these insurgents that are coming in are rebels rising up from the neighborhoods and banding together and fighting back against an evil government when in fact that's not what's happening. The Syrian army is protecting its people. These people that are rising up as insurgents fighting them aren't even from there. They're all trucked in from out of the country by us.
Yeah.
These are the same mercenaries that worked for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there are 25 sides in that, and they're all fighting each other. And I think that it takes creation of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And you heard, and I think we've proven it with the drone bombings and stuff, you hurt enough people and all of a sudden everybody's going to start trying to kill you. And so and there are people, you know, the whole tinfoil hat people who say that, you know, Assad never did that gassing. It was done by somebody else so that the U.S. would start bombing Assad's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just know that. We kill children. The United States of America is a big baby killer. And
yeah.
We aren't going to save lives by bombing Syria.
We aren't the only people that are killing children inadvertently or directly, but we are certainly aware that we do, and we don't make any steps to slow it down or stop it. I mean, one man's collateral damage is another man's six-year-old child, and you just made an enemy for life.
Right, of he and all of his family.
And all his neighbors, and everybody that knows about that, because to them, if any other country were to start bombing us indiscriminately,
yeah,
I mean, you saw what 9/11 did.
Yeah.
Okay, and all those people that died. And what did we do? We galvanized and said, okay, you want to play like that? Okay, we'll play like that.
Toby and Keith.
And then you see what, yeah.
Now, one last question. Completely personal, okay? All this worldwide domination aside and how the world would be run better if it were you and me, Steve, let's face it. Mm-hmm. I was at the house today before my crazy day began. You know, this was probably an hour before I went away. I went to go on the bus, the bus that went crazy. And one of the people I live with, there's a little keychain, and it has two keys on it, one to the house and one to the bike lock. I don't have a car. I just have a bicycle. So one key to the car, one key to the bike lock is on this little rubber band that's on the, bless you, Brett sneezed, that's on the fire extinguisher on the way out of the house. So there's a one rubber band with two keys on it, the house key and the bike key. And one of the people I work with walked up to me with this thing and was holding it and said, did you do this? And I looked, and both keys were out sideways. I am not making this up. Both keys were perfectly out sideways, like a cheerleader doing a big kick split.
Mm-hmm.
And they were bent away from each other like a propeller. Like if I had dropped the key set, I think it would have spun.
Mm-hmm.
But they were bent at 90-degree angles, both of these keys.
Mm-hmm.
Any of your spidey sense telling you anything?
Do you remember the little girl?
Yeah. Now, real quick, Steve has seen in the past that there's a little girl who waits for me somewhere, right? Is that short enough? I really shortened the whole story, but she waits for me.
She caught sight of you first when you used to go downtown, and you'd be walking to the hotel or to the shelter. She would see you, and then she followed you from then on. The thing is that she's not corporeal.
Meaning she's not alive?
She's not. She's alive spiritually. She's, she died. As you know, she left her body as a little girl, and she's still around. She hasn't gone. She hasn't moved on. And you left.
I did. I left Pennsylvania for about 14 months, and went to work for Stephen King in Maine, and came back.
Right. Yeah. And now you're back.
Mm-hmm.
And time and space are a different thing in her dimension. When we die, we go to a We don't go anywhere. Like there's no, you don't get on a train and go somewhere. You simply shift dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And she's able to switch back and forth. That's what ghosts are. They're either a timestamp, or there's no one there. You're simply seeing a replay of something that happened in time, or you're seeing someone who's really there who doesn't have their body anymore. And that's her. And so she is still around. And you haven't shaken her yet.
Why bend the keys?
Well, energy is a funny thing. When you're in different dimensions, that energy, the same type of energy that allows for me to utilize photons somewhere where I'm not and be able to see what's there and instantaneously be able to tell you what it is the same type of energy that can manipulate it. You know, it can be manipulated so that you can bend metal, you can redirect something, time can slow.
So the keys were just an accident. There was no message in the bent keys.
There was nothing sardonic or nothing ominous.
No, I don't even mean something positive, like, don't go out.
No, it was a calling card.
Hmm.
It was a calling card, like,
It's not that there's a magnetic pulse in the house and it's going to blow up later because the electric company screwed something up.
Yeah, the government's beam weapon missed and hit your keys instead, right?
You know, as you said earlier, I believe in nothing. So when these crazy little things happen, I'm just, that's interesting. But I have no explanation for it either.
Right. Well, anything can be explained on a scientific level, right?
Yeah.
If you see evidence of something, then you can, that's the effect. You can find the cause. If your keys were bent, they were bent, meaning it was a verb. Someone bent them.
Right.
Okay. And so it's a calling card. So you'll see this. I know you'll look for your keys. Therefore, this is what will happen to your keys. You will see me. This is how you see me.
Oh, interesting. Right. Steve, thank you for taking the time. IlluminatiNetwork.com. Okay, great. People want to check it out. And if somebody wants to get a radio show, come up with a great proposal and pitch it on over to Steve. And who knows, you may be the newest program on the Illuminati Network.
Take your seat among the weirdos.
Hey, thanks for everything, Steve. Have a wonderful evening.
We'll see you later.
Yep. I'm Pat Lamar, filling in for Rick Smith on The Rick Smith Show, and we're going to come back in just a minute.
The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
With its merger taking off, American Airlines' swashbuckling PR slogan proclaimed, "Two great airlines, one great future." That wasn't about its present attempt to merge with U.S. Airways, but about its 2001 takeover of TWA. Since then, American's honchos have relentlessly cut flights, jacked up fees, fired thousands of excellent employees, turned flying into a misery, and plunged the high-flying corporation into bankruptcy. Some great future. Now, American wants to take the same route by hooking up with U.S. Air, again proclaiming that the combination will be great. But for whom? Not for passengers. In July, Consumer Reports magazine revealed that American and U.S. Air were tied for ninth worst out of 11 big airlines in a survey of customer satisfaction. Two bad performers won't add up to a good one. Indeed, the combined entity looks to be so bad for the flying public that even the toothless antitrust watchdogs of the Justice Department are at least barking at this merger, having filed suit to block it. If the two join, only four giants would control nearly 90% of U.S. flights. Well, snapped the oligopolist, that's just how the free market works. Yeah, as in free to gouge. From its earliest days, this industry has been heavily subsidized and protected, and the last thing its bureaucratic profiteers want is actually having to compete with each other. They haven't become giants by being agile competitors for customer loyalty, but by dividing up the market, colluding on price hikes, cutting amenities, and slashing service. Their only area of real competition is in the annual race to see which airline CEO gets the fattest paycheck. This is Jim Hightower saying, if this merger goes through, get ready for the big four to merge into two, and then the two becomes one, all in the name of free market competition.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show. I got news for you.
This is Pat LaMarche. I am in tonight for Rick Smith. Rick is taking a whole pile of days off this week. It's like he thinks it's the kids went back to school. Aha, that's why. Take the time off when the kids aren't home. Actually, he's home when they get off out of school in the evening, and that's a nice surprise, I'm sure, for them. We're going to go to Talk Radio News right now with Bob Ney. Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I'm great. Well, actually, I've been rather traumatized this evening. I take the bus to work because I'm a good peasant. And I actually love the bus, and I ride the bus in, and then I get a ride home because I don't have a car for more of the same reasons. There's this little old man that gets on the bus at one of the stops, and the bus driver actually gets off the bus and helps him to the sidewalk because he's so frail, and I'm sure that the bus driver's not supposed to do that, right?
Right.
Today the guy said, no, I'm okay, and just turned around, and all of a sudden his face turned purple. He just flipped off the side of the bus and smashed his head into the sidewalk.
Oh.
Yeah, the road, actually, the middle of the road. And the bus driver jumped off, and then I jumped off, and, oh, my gosh, I've never seen that much blood ever in my life. So he was, by the time the ambulance took him away, he was still, you know, conscious and stuff. He was actually, I think, unconscious when he hit the ground. But anyway, so forgive me if I don't know anything and I make no sense and I can't string sentences together.
Oh, it took, I walked outside the Capitol one day and I heard crack, this loud crack, and I looked at this huge branch came down, and this older gentleman, I'd say, you know, maybe he's about 80, mm-hmm. pushed this kid aside, and the branch fell straight on him. And then we just got sick to, it was a round trunk. I shouldn't say branch. It was thick. And we were just sick to our stomachs because we were sure he was dead. There was a knot on one end that was long enough and part of the tree stuck out, and that it didn't crush his head.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
But it hit his head into the, sidewalk. And
yeah.
It was just, they're just awful. You, like what you went through, you see that and you're just makes you sick.
Yeah, and the poor boy, I ended up holding this man's head because he was trying not to have his head down on the ground, you know. And I held his hands at first, and then out of nowhere, some guy came with rubber gloves. I know I was focused, so I wasn't really paying attention to my surroundings. So this guy hands me rubber gloves, and then the man said he wanted something to hold his head up, and I didn't have anything but my hands. So I held his head up, and the other guy tried to put gauze before the ambulance came on his head.
It's kind of amazing what you do when you have to.
Yeah. And the blood just went around the gauze, and I thought, oh, my God, this is awful. And then as soon as the ambulance got this guy taken care of, I turned around, and one of the young kids that was on the bus, like a 20-year-old kid who wears, like, skateboard pants, you know,
right.
just, bam, passed out right in front of me.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
oh,
wow. Poor kid. So I ran to him, and then luckily another ambulance had gotten there by then, and that paramedic came and helped. And it was remarkable how overwhelming it was. How do people survive the trauma of war?
I don't know. I used to visit the troops at Ramstein Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Lundstall.
Yeah.
Oh, I still tell people when you're having a bad day, I think about the 19-year-old young man from New York.
Mm.
And they said, he's paralyzed from the neck down. He touches his forehead. He likes to have the contact.
Yeah.
And I didn't even say, how are you?
Right.
But I just said, thank you for your service. And he starts to tell me, well, I'm going to go to school, and they have these machines now, and I can breathe into it and type things. And
yeah.
I was like, wow. So when I have a bad day,
You remember him.
I don't know how they survive trauma like that.
I don't know either and what they witness. Well, so that's a nice segue to Congress isn't really going to let this president go to war. Is that possible? We're going to start bombing Syria?
Well, I noticed. I think we're going to drop some bombs. That's my belief, and it's going to happen soon. The president, let's look at congressional speak. I was out there, so I can translate easily.
Go ahead.
Three
I
things.
Need a translation.
Yeah, well, three things. One, the president says that he does not seek United Nations approval. He's seeking humanitarian law, human rights law. Well, that's there from Kosovo and genocide, if you want it to be.
Mm.
Second, he's not seeking congressional approval. And John Boehner, the Republican speaker, had a conversation, didn't ask him to seek, just said communicate with Congress. Okay, so that's number
two. Wait a minute.
Two.
These guys won't let that president blow his nose without permission.
Well, they're going to let him bomb something. I'm telling you. So Boehner says communicate. And nobody wants to take this you know, for a vote. And the third thing is, if our intelligence certifies that the government did it, it'll be a quick, I predict, and this, I talked to some people on the Hill today, they think it'll be a quick hit. It'll be, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days, and that's, of course, some of the media outlets are reporting, but they're trying to scoop each other. But 2 or 3 days, it'll be a quick hit in military installations. But once you start down this path, you just don't know what's going to happen.
Is this a departure from the kind of, quote-unquote, permission he received for Libya?
Yes, it actually, the way it's going, unless something changes, now, you know, the way Congress is, somebody can start to demand something.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bit of a departure, but of course, Libya, we were providing services and some other people had ran equipment in there for us, so I don't know. I think it's a little bit different scenario. He doesn't need war powers. People might debate that type of thing.
I would be happy to debate that.
But yeah. People do. They do all the time. I think one thing that sticks in my mind is this. The recent statements, and this goes from Bush in Afghanistan and President Obama. It's not just Obama. He didn't start that war.
Mm-hmm.
But something that sticks in my mind, and I'd apply it to Syria or anything else, as we're trying to exit Afghanistan, what did we say? Well, we need to stay a little bit longer because if we don't, within, 3 weeks, the Taliban could make some, you know, resurgence.
Mm-hmm.
So they're telling me, my country's telling me that after 12 years,
yeah,
the best we can do is when we leave to have 3 weeks. So let's take another 12 and have 6 weeks when we leave. So when you start to think in those terms, when you hear our government say, well, we're just going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes this turns to that. I think they have to be very careful.
You know, I love my country, which is why I'm so annoyed that it sucks so bad right now.
Yeah.
You know, I will tell you who kills children, possibly Assad, but the United States of America. And I do not want any innocent people in any more harm's way than necessary. Obviously, you know, I'm a bleeding heart crazy. When it comes to tree hugging, hippie freak, liberal, crazy, bleeding heart nuts, I'm it. But I'm so tired of us bombing things and pretending it's not hitting people who aren't innocent.
Well, like the drone, you know, we have killed a 16-year-old American boy,
uh-huh,
and we've killed him.
Yeah.
Now, he can be the son of the militant monster, you know, Taliban or whatever, but he was a 16-year-old American citizen that the drone went in and killed. Now, I know casualties happen during, quote, war, but these are drone strikes, and, you know, you look at it, and I understand things can't be perfect, but I just think... And what boggles my mind, I guess, we're sitting and reacting to 1,000 people, which is horrible.
Uh-huh.
Gas attack. Darfur had genocide of 400,000 people. Darfur did.
Right. And Bhopal had 2,000 killed by a company.
A company. And we kind of sit and go, okay, well, that was then, this is now, and that was a different president, blah, blah, blah. But our theories of selective intervention have always applied,
yeah,
I think.
So why Syria?
Historically.
I mean, you know, I believe it's war without end, amen, is our plan. But, you know, we will, as you said, as you just pointed out, allow all kinds of bad stuff to happen and
Well, the president has been restrained, for example, on Iran. I mean, Dick Cheney wanted to bomb Iran so bad. He still wants to bomb Iran. He just wanted, I think he said bomb Iran and Bush misspelled it. I-R-A-Q, I really do.
Well, Bush isn't real good at spelling.
Yeah, I think he misspelled it.
Yeah.
But, you know, Cheney always wanted to bomb Iran. The president's had some restraint on that. There's people, there's forces, money forces that want the president to bomb Iran, et cetera, and he's restrained himself on that. The Syria thing, you know, the statement was made, if you use chemical weapons, you have crossed that line, something to that extent.
Yeah.
And once you make it, and then you get this heat, well, what are you really going to do about it? But there's a lot of horrible things that happen on Earth, and we don't step in on many of them.
Right. So what about the tinfoil hat people, that this was an excuse? Because it wasn't all the Assad administration. It might have been, well, if that's the way we have to get you in. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, I personally don't think that people could be that horrible, but then I have to remember Auschwitz. So,
well, yeah, you never. I mean, you don't know who's doing what over there, too. Right. And also, there's a lot of thugs. I looked with amazement when they said, "Well, the Al Qaeda has, what's the clandestinely infiltrated the resistance. I don't believe for a second Al-Qaeda infiltrated. I think they walked up and said, we'll fight Assad, then America next. We're Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. In that part of the world, you don't have to infiltrate.
Right.
So, you know, you start to look at who's the enemy, not that Assad's a picnic.
Right. Especially, though, after those drone strikes where, you know, it's not just one 16-year-old. There's the every week you read a story. Last week there was a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old who were killed in one of those drone strikes. You know, I mean, I think those do help make terrorists because they're terrifying.
Well, and the other thing, too, is our credibility as a country. Look, you know, I was in Congress when they did all the secret things and took us on the floor and showed us all the secret information and the moving of this and the weapons of mass destruction, and everybody got pretty hyper, and we gave George Bush full force and authority. And people many times ask me, you know, what was I most ashamed of in my career? And they expect to answer, you know, Jack Abramoff.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one thing I'm most distressed over and ashamed of is that vote.
Yeah.
We lied.
Yeah.
I mean, not, we were lied to, but nobody corrected that. Nobody went back and said, well,
right.
Bring in these people. They're war criminals. Nobody did that.
I know. I know. And I think it's so that they could have carte blanche now.
And when the Democrats came into power in the Congress, they didn't want to kind of stir stuff up and they would look political. That's always the problem with both parties. They're going to look political. But history allowed us to invade a country.
Mm-hmm.
On a lie, and kill thousands of people, and kill thousands of our own people on a lie.
Yeah. I don't think they're going to be political. I think they're already culpable. And I think Nancy Pelosi's a bag of skin. And I think the fact that she didn't take those two, Bush and Cheney, when she took House Resolution 333 off the table so that no one would impeach Cheney, they had the control of the House. They had taken control back because the American people were sick of it. And I think that it's also that no matter who's in charge, they run the deck of cards. And I hate to be so cynical. I'm just awful.
Well, again, though, you're correct. Look, the vote was based on a lie. They should have at least called in the people that lied and done something with them.
Right, right.
You know, because they led us to killing people, which basically was a form of murder because they lied in order to get us into the country.
Right. Now, Bob Ney, sometime maybe next week or the week after, in addition to the news, if you do the news with me, can I have you on for your own half hour so we can talk about your book and
Your
experiences and stuff? Because that would be really wonderful.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then one last story I just want to mention real quickly
is
maybe just condolences to the family of Neil Armstrong. He passed away shortly ago.
From Wapakoneta, Ohio. You mean the astronaut?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I met Neil Armstrong.
You did?
Yes. He was I don't mean this in a bad way. He was a recluse of type.
Well, you know, you go in outer space. Nobody understands you.
He was a bit of a recluse of type, but
yeah.
I met Neil Armstrong. Of course, John Glenn, the day he came back to Muskingum County, Ohio, from a trip from outer space, I met him when I was a kid. So that was neat, but
Neil Armstrong, 82, commander of Apollo 11. When it comes to heroes, when I was a little kid, the astronauts were it.
I still remember that.
Yeah. Pretty
we stayed up. Didn't we have to, what was it, 3 o'clock in the morning you had to be up to watch it or something?
I remember watching it. We were hunkered down in the basement. And I remember it. I don't remember the 69, right?
Yeah, and we had a black and white TV.
Yeah, we did. But I was 9. And I just remember, like, my older brother, who is now the vice provost of Princeton, so he's kind of a nerd. You know, he was then 16, and he was literally jumping up and down watching TV. It was just spectacular. So, anyway. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me about some of these tough issues.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah. Bob Ney, Talk Radio News. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith, and we'll be right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
I have to tell you, if I was going to have a bad evening, I'm so glad that I had Brett Benatelli to come visit because he's definitely made my evening much, much better. And what a great bunch of guests, and thank you for joining us. And I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. This is the Rick Smith Show. He does have tomorrow night off as well, but he will be back on Thursday night. Another great guest tomorrow, I mean a great guest host tomorrow. Night that is a regular here and you'll enjoy. Welfare drug testing. Now, just for the simple reason, we had a wonderful libertarian dude on tonight. He, you know, like I said, if we had a libertarian president, I'd have half of everything I want. I didn't ask him about this, but, you know, drug testing people so that they can get food stamps, and I'm sure the libertarians don't think food stamps are appropriate either, or TANF benefits or any of that stuff, has gone on in a few states. Florida did it. It was challenged by the ACLU in Florida. It was found to be unconstitutional. It was also found that it didn't really yield anything. Other states, the civil liberties groups have not been so quick. They haven't been fast enough on the draw. And, well, in the state of Utah, for example, they have been drug testing now for over a year for people who apply for benefits. There are 4,730 applicants for public assistance. Let me see, that's 4,730. I've got to write this down. I was a mathematician, so I don't know what to pay. 4,730 people applied for temporary assistance for needy families. So those are TANF applicants. We used to call it welfare. And, oh, guess how many drugs? Guess how many people were found to use drugs? 4,730. Do you want to guess, Brett? No. Two. You're a little too trusting, Brett. They found 12. Out of 4,730 applicants, now, on average, the general population, 8% admit to using drugs in the last 30 days. 8% of the general population has used an illegal drug in the last 30 days. Of the 4,730 people who applied for TANF in Utah last year, 12 of them. 12. Utah's drug screening cost, $31,000. Now, I will say one thing good about Utah, and maybe we should mark this down. One thing good about Utah in the badness, the goodness with the badness inside it, it's kind of like nougat. They didn't throw the people off the TANF They did not deny them TANF. They sent them to rehab. So they identify them with illegal drugs in their system. They didn't incarcerate them or take away their assistance. They sent them to rehab. So now I don't believe in mandatory rehab either, but at least they didn't do something just so ridiculous, ridiculous. My friend Diane Nyland, who runs Hear Us, she's the director and founder of Hear Us, which is an advocacy group for homeless children, national advocacy group for homeless children, was excited when she heard Paul Ryan say that the war on poverty wasn't working because people don't know what it's like to be poor. And then, of course, he challenged President Obama and said, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know anything about the poor. You ought to go work with them. You ought to go live with them. You ought to go meet the people that work with them. And so Diane, who runs one of these charities, got a hold of Paul Ryan, and she said, why don't you come and ride with me? So she sent me a copy of the letter. The invitation that she wrote to introduce Paul Ryan, Wisconsin's first district congressperson in the United States and our last vice presidential candidate from the Grand Old Party. She wrote to him and said, you can ride with me. I'll introduce you to homeless people. I'll introduce you to the advocates. I'll introduce you to people you can. And silence, has not heard anything yet. So I thought, well, that'd be fun to give old Paul Ryan's office a call, see if he wants to come on the Rick Smith Show. See if he wants to talk about poverty or any of his people do, or even just if I could get a quick interview with him and write a Huffington Post post about it. The phone doesn't work. I called every single phone number for the congressman. I called his Washington, D.C. office. I called his Janesville, Wisconsin office. I called his Racine office. I called his Kenosha office. Not one of his office phones was answered. And every single one of the office phones said that at this time we're too busy to take your phone call. If you would like to talk to the Racine office, press this. So I called them directly. I did the press the number and we'll transfer you. And I called the Washington office. Then it said, if you know a party's extension, you can dial. I tried that. Nothing. I emailed the congressman. I was not allowed to email him unless I had a Wisconsin zip code. So I looked up a Wisconsin zip code and I put that in and wrote to him. Why are you not taking my emails? You won't even take an email from someone. Do you know who pays your salary, Congressman Ryan? Do you know who pays for your health benefits, Congressman Ryan? Do you know who pays for you to go home and take a vacation? The United States of American taxpayers. It doesn't just come from Wisconsin. How dare you not allow people to write to you? Anyway, not surprisingly, I haven't heard anything back yet either. We'll keep you posted. One last thing. Pat Robertson says that gays wear special AIDS rings. Now, it's not like the bracelet you might wear to say, I'm a big fan of Lance Armstrong. He says that gay people, this was on his most recent 700 Club program, gays wear special rings so that when they shake your hand, they can cut you and transmit AIDS to you. Pat Robertson on our airwaves. How does this continue? This absolute idiot. And, you know, people send him money. They believe him. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith. A treat as always. Thank you, Brett. You've been just such a wonderful producer. And we'll see you. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, infinite.